Hello, and welcome to SoberCast, where we provide AA speaker meetings and workshops in podcast format. We're an ad-free podcast, and if you enjoy listening, please help us be self-supporting by visiting SoberCast.com, look for the donate link, and drop a dollar or two into our virtual basket. We hope you enjoy the podcast. Have a great day.
Well, good morning, everybody. My name's Sandy.
Alcoholic.
And Bob got more applause than I did. Anyway, my sobriety date is December 7th, 1964. And if you're wondering why the schedule got changed, Bob went to the committee and pointed out to them that Sandy was on for 2.5 hours on some very heavy material, probably would be going over his head. Partway through, it would start falling apart, and it would make the conference look bad. So he decided to be here as a backup and to make sure nothing really got screwed up. The truth is that we really enjoy any opportunity to just play off each other. We just start talking. After a while, we stop, and then the other one picks up, and we go on from there. I was going to start out with some thoughts on the history of AA. I'm not going to talk about the entire history of AA, but I had no interest in history growing up. I hated it in school. It already happened. What the hell you want to look at that for? And the same applied when I got to AA. I was so disinterested in it that I never even went up and met Bill Wilson, which would have been real easy. I'd go to the Bill Wilson dinner. I had about 7 years to do that. And who wants to meet Bill Wilson? I mean, I need money. I got problems down here. I don't know. And, of course, as time went on, you can realize how much I wish I had gone to at least shake his hand. Then when I took an interest in AA history, probably reading AA Comes of Age and then The Best of All, Not God by Ernest Kurtz, I suddenly realized that anyone who studied this history would become a believer in God, that there was just no way you could read this and not realize that there was a guiding force that was going to save all the alcoholics or give them a chance on the planet, in spite of Bill Wilson. And so, not in spite of his energy, but in spite of what his ideas were and how this ought to be done. And I think when I think about that, because he is my big hero in AA, I got two heroes, Bill Wilson and Chuck Chamberlain. Those are my two people I'd like to sit and talk with for about 200 years and just pick their brain and listen to them answer questions. And by the way, we are going to have, if anybody wants to ask questions, either anything we're talking about or any spiritual point that you're curious about, from 11 to 11:30, there'll be an opportunity there, and then in the afternoon, we'll save some time at the end. If there isn't, we'll just keep on talking, so don't worry about that. But sometimes people do want. I know I had a lot of questions for Chuck. When I think of Bill going in one direction and being corrected, which is kind of what I was going to talk about in terms of history, the first example, of course, was how he initially wanted to sober alcoholics up by telling them all about the spiritual awakening and the mountaintops and the wind was blowing, and he'd go into bars with this experience that he just had and tell the alcoholics, you don't have to be like this anymore. You can have a white light come into your room, and you'll be on top of a mountain, and the wind will be blowing, and your whole life will be transformed. You'll be just like me. It'll be wonderful. And as you can imagine, he got no takers. No one was going, oh, good, I'm going to stop drinking and go join you on that. And some of them allowed is how that happened when they drank rum. And they didn't need an Archer one. And it was Dr. Silkworth who just said, Bill, this is what I think. I think you should hammer home the hopelessness of alcohol before you talk about anything else. And there comes our first step. And how important that is. It's so important it takes up 45 or 50 pages of the big book before you even get to step two. Because unless someone does that 100%, and they realize how necessary the rest of the steps are, they're really not going to take them in the proper way. They have to be taken out of necessity, not out of curiosity. And when you suddenly realize, when I work with new people, I try to convince them that their situation is a lot worse than they think it is. And they may be in jail facing through all this, and they go, yeah, but it's a lot worse than that. Let me explain how bad it is. Until they see the fatal nature of it, and then their mind naturally turns to matters of God as the only way out of the dilemma that they're in. So we can thank Dr. Silkworth for that. But the other area that I always like to recollect is in 1937, when Bill had already met Dr. Bob and they were starting to work with some alcoholics out in Akron, and he went back and was getting some out of town's hospital. He got Hank Parkhurst and Jim Burwell and Fitz Mayo, and Fitz started AA in D.C. where I got sober. And so they were having this success, and he was back out with Dr. Bob, and they started counting up how many they had. And I think they came up with something like 20 or 21 who had a good chunk of sobriety. And it dawned on them that they really had something that could save the alcoholics all over the world, and that it was essential that they get this message out. So they started brainstorming on how to do it, and of course Bill's the champion brainstormer, way ahead of everybody else. And he said, well, it's clear to me that this has to be divided into three parts, that first of all, we need a lot of money. That was always the answer if you came from Wall Street. We need a lot of money, a lot of money. And with the money, we can pay missionaries to go to other cities, meaning alcoholics that they had sober, they would pay them. They could take time off from their job and go out to Des Moines, Iowa, or someplace like that, and then get it started there, and then pay them to go somewhere else. So we clearly need that. And then since the hospitals aren't too happy with us because we throw up all over their rooms and make a lot of noise and other things, we're going to have to start a lot of drunk tanks. And as a matter of fact, I think the idea of chain stores had just started. So he said, we need a chain of drunk tanks all across the country. And then we need a book. We need some sort of literature that'll explain all this. Well, he couldn't go anywhere without the group conscience. Even back then, you had to get the rest of the drunks to go along with whatever the plan was. And they thought that, they didn't buy any of that. What do you mean, chain of drunk Peyton? No, I don't get this. But Bill had a trump card that he always played when he was meeting resistance to his ideas. And his trump card was, why, within gunshot range of here, there's tens of thousands of alcoholics that are dying. And if we don't get this word out to them, their deaths will be on your hands. And, oh, okay. So, by a very slim margin, he got the okay to go back to New York and raise a lot of money. And he gets back to New York, and he finds out that people aren't that anxious to donate money to sobering alcoholics up. They thought that some of them were sober enough in the Salvation Army and the churches, and he met tremendous resistance and went around all over the place, and it really discouraged him. But, you know, the guy had this drive ever since he had his spiritual awakening. Part of that awakening was to pass the message on. It was built in with the awakening. I think it's built into everybody's awakening. That when it happens to you in AA, you just want to go out and show the next person how to have one of these. It's just part of the deal. Anyway, it wasn't going that well, and so he was talking to his brother-in-law, who was helped him out. He paid Leonard Strong, who helped. He paid his way through Towns Hospital four times, and he was talking to him about this. That I'm going to these people, and nobody seems to want to help us. And Dr. Strong said, "Well, you know, I think I know somebody up in the Rockefeller office that I met through someone else, and I could give them a call." And he made the call, and the man remembered him, and it turned out that the person he knew up there was Rockefeller's right-hand man, Willard Richardson. And he kind of passed on what was going to be put in front of Rockefeller to look at in terms of projects to donate to. So they went up there, and Bill talked, and he said, "Gee, that's fascinating. Would you like to have lunch, and we could talk this over even more?" And Bill's going, "We're getting close to the money now." And he got so excited about it that he set up a meeting with some of the Rockefeller advisors, who were people, publishers, bankers, the head of the Riverside Church, the chairman of the board, and Bill and Dr. Bob came to town, and they presented to them. And they were so impressed that they decided to send one of their number out to Akron to totally investigate what's going on out there. You know, the hospital and Dr. Bob and the meeting in the Williams house, the Oxford meeting, and prepare a report. And they prepared this report, and they brought it into Rockefeller. And Bill kept waiting for a report on this, and he didn't hear anything. And finally, Mr. Richardson said, "Well, we talked to him, and he said, 'I'm very, very impressed with this. I think this is one of the best things ever come up in the world. That's how much I think of it. But I think money will spoil it. So I'm going to donate a small amount of money so that Dr. Bob doesn't lose his house. And it'll give them a little salary. I'll put it in the Riverside Church and give them a little salary to go on while they go on. But this looks like a word of mouth thing to me, and I don't want to mess it up.'" And so the panel went along with that, and everybody went along with it except Bill. He said, no, he doesn't understand. We need big money. We need a big chain of drugs. We got to raise money." And in spite of what Rockefeller said, Bill was so persuasive, he persuaded that little group of advisors to form a foundation. And then we'll use the foundation to raise the money, because it'll be tax exempt, and people may be more than likely to donate to it. And so he created the Alcoholic Foundation, which was the beginning of our World Service and General Service. So that was the first creation, and it got set up, and so he had this Alcoholic Foundation, and he started going out raising money, and nobody would donate to the Alcoholic Foundation. And it just stalled completely. And there was a few other things that happened, but it really stalled, and Bill shifted his attention. And this is where we really are blessed. He said, "Well, we need a book, and I think we should shift our fundraising activities to writing the book and then selling them all over the country." And so in the middle of the foundation fundraising, he changed the plan to write a book and use that as a means. So in other words, the book was being written primarily to get the money to get this whole thing going. And eventually the book did supply a lot of income into Alcoholics Anonymous, but it certainly didn't right off the bat. And so I'm just going to stop there with the beginning of the big book, and I told Bob he can pick up from there or touch on his favorite part of history. So I'll turn it over to my great friend Bob.
Hi, I'm Bob. I'm an alcoholic. Sober since the 10th of December, 1967. Yeah, that's interesting. I do think anybody who would study the history of Alcoholics Anonymous would have to come to the conclusion that there is a God. It is, we are such a ragged group of folks. And it was kind of like Noah's Ark. I mean, there was one of everything that helped form the fellowship. And the most astounding thing is you can't, to me, the thread that winds through it all is that through God's grace and through Bill's great insight, they kept selecting the right thing at every turn. Even when his instinct would be to go raise a lot of money or start hospitals, the other members said, no, we're not going to do that. And Bill would align himself. I mean, Bill really gave up. I mean, he was broke. And he was offered a job, you know, with $300 or $400 a month at Towns Hospital to, you know, to do the work over there. He comes back to the group to tell the group that, you know, this is really a great start. You know, if Charles Towns would recognize what we're doing and give it his okay, and we'll reach a lot more people. And just think of that small group of, you know, 10 guys, 15 guys that sat around and said, Bill, this is. And they're in his living room in the house that he's about to lose. They know he's in deep trouble. They know his wife's working at the department store. And his wife and he lived in 52 different places in those 2 years, from about 1937 from 1938 to 1940. They lived in 52 different locations. I mean, you talk about a love story. They had that on television the other night, you know, when love is not enough, you know, for Lois Wilson. But at every turn, whether it was following the advice, you know, Abby comes in, he lights Bill's light about, you know, the Oxford group and the grace of God, and Bill gets inspired, and Bill has a spiritual awakening in Towns Hospital, gets sober in November of 1934. He works with 75 people, no one gets well, one commits suicide in his house. He's having zero luck. No job. And Silkworth comes to him just before he goes down to Akron to do the little proxy fight down there and gives him the information that Sandy talked about, you know, why don't you have to hit him with the physical, with the disease aspect of it before you start hitting him with the spiritual. And that coupled with the comment that Lois made to him before he went down, Bill was tended to depression, and he's really down, and he's saying, no one's getting well, this isn't working. And she said, well, it's working for you, honey. You know, you're sober. So those two little magic pieces came together when he, you know, you went to that retreat in Nashville that where they talk about the phone call from the lobby. I've been in the Mayflower Hotel at that telephone. Thinking about Bill. So Bill's deals fall through. He's broke. He can't even pay his hotel bill. He's in the lobby of the Mayflower Hotel and thinking about having a drink. And he put the idea together that he needed another alcoholic to keep himself sober. Up until that time, he was driven by the spiritual idea of sharing and going to help and change another person's life. He really didn't, I don't think, as strongly as he were to have later understood that he needed a drunk for him to stay sober. He calls Tunks. Tunks gives him a list of 10 names. Henrietta Cyberling was the 10th name. He called 10 different people. Now you think of how many of us would have stopped at one or two. He called all 10. Which to me, in a depressed state in the lobby of the Mayflower Hotel, I mean, that is the grace of God. By a factor, he goes and meets Henrietta Cyberling, and when he meets Bob, I mean, he comes through with these, he now knows two things that he really didn't know before, that he has to hit him with the physical, and then he explains to Bob that he's really there as much for himself as he is to do any, and that is the thing that everybody kept on saying, you can't talk down to alcoholics. You have to meet them, you know, and that statement where he's there with his own vulnerability saying that I found an answer, but I'm in trouble. You know, I was looking for someone else to talk to and, you know, you were the guy that was giving me. So thanks for giving me the time because it's helping me, you know, go do this. And every turn of our history is just by little threads. They pick the right thing, the right tone of the book, the right, you know, that he takes the six steps and expands them you know, I'm sure you're going to, you know, get into that more. So that's all I have to say on that. And I will give it back to my friend.
Oh, my God. You all right? Let the record show he did not use up all his time. Anyway, I'm going to just go back and pick up on the book project. Bill had put together a couple chapters trying to raise money. It was part of his fundraising when he'd talk around. He had his story and more about alcoholism and part of the doctor's opinion. That first section, if you look at that, there's two sections to the doctor's opinion. And one, the first section ends with, "You can absolutely trust anything these men say to you." Pretty good fundraiser thing, if you know what I mean. But that wasn't working, and so they sat down. He mainly sat down with his business partner, Hank Parkhurst, who had gotten sober out of Towns Hospital in 1935 or 6. And he was a wheeler dealer, great power driver. He wrote the chapter to the employer because, you know, the beginning of that chapter says, "I used to be in charge of a department with 3,000 people." Well, that was Standard Oil in New Jersey, and that's where he worked. And so, after they'd been sober a while, he said, "Why don't you come over and be my partner in New Jersey? I have this little office over there, and we're going to form a little deal so that we can, a co-op, so that, gasoline dealers in New Jersey can purchase products cheaper as a big group. And we'll call it the Honor Dealers." And so that's where Bill and Hank would hang out, trying to do a little work on raising money, but they mostly were sobering up drunks who would show up in the office and then they'd sit there and talk to them all day. And Hank had a secretary named Ruth Hout. And she became quite well known in AA history because she ended up being Bill's secretary for 25 or 30 years. And she actually typed the big book in that little office. And, so he got talking with Hank about, "Well, how are we going to pay for this book?" And Hank said, "Well, it's real easy. We'll incorporate into a publishing company. We'll get stock certificates and we'll sell the stock at the AA meetings to the drunks." So Bill said, "Well, how do you incorporate? You don't have to worry about really incorporating. Watch this." And he went into a stationery store, he bought a blank pad of stock certificates, and he just wrote, and he made up the name Works Publishing Company, because the big book was going to be the first in a series of great works that were going to be done by this publishing company. Without checking with Bill, he just signed his down the bottom, "Hank Parker is president." So he just went around Bill and became president on the stock certificates. And they went out and started selling them, and the drunks weren't buying it. "You want us to buy stock in a book that hasn't been written yet? Yeah, but you're going to be in it. We're going to get your story." "No, no, we're not interested in that." So Bill went to Harper's Publishing and showed the chapters that he had there, and the religious editor there said, "Gee, this is pretty good. Can you write something, the whole book?" "Oh, yeah." And he said, "Well, I'll give you a $1,500 advance," which was a lot of money in the 30s. And they got back, and a lot of advisors said, "You ought to take it and then just write the book and share everything with Harper's." But they got back and they said, "No, we want the fellowship to own the book. We don't want the Harper's to be involved in it. So we're going to do our own publishing ourselves." And but that helped sell a few shares of stock that this company was willing to give Bill $1,500 on just the two chapters that had been already written. And so that brought in a little bit of money. Then he got an Irishman who knew a radio broadcaster named Gabriel Heater. And he had a bit, was very popular, and he had a little human interest section in there. And he agreed to allow this Irishman to come on and talk for 2 minutes about his story and the book that was coming out, Alcoholics Anonymous. And this man had a problem staying sober, and so once they got the date for the radio broadcast, Bill got real nervous that he wouldn't make it, wouldn't stay sober. So they got a room in the YMCA in downtown New York, and they had an AA guard on there 24 hours a day for 10 days or whatever it was until he appeared on the Gabriel Heater radio show. And that show caused the drunks to buy some more stock. So, and Dr. Silkworth bought some, and Dr. Towns of Towns Hospital bought about $1,000 worth. And so they had assembled enough money to keep on going in terms of raising money for the book. And so they went to a printer. Oh, and they went out and circulated the chapters. Bill wrote all of the chapters except the employer. And then they went out and got the stories. And most of the stories came from Akron because there was a newspaper guy out there who would actually write the stories for the drunks. He would interview them, he'd highlight their things. And so there was a bigger percentage that came from Akron than New York. And in New York, the drunks wrote their own stories. So the ones that were written in New York were twice as long as the ones that were written in Akron. Because if you're writing your own story, you're going to really put a big story in there. So Bill and Hank had to edit it on their own without asking permission, because none of the drunks would have given permission. And then when they saw what had been done, they said, wait a minute, you took out half my story, and they're all upset. And they said, no, we have to reduce it. Anyway, they got the stories in there. And then came the content, and this is where I'm going to just tell this part and then stop. The real content of the 12 steps, how the program works, which Bill postponed to the very last, writing how it works, because he knew it was going to cause controversy. Everything that you tried in the group caused controversy. It's just like having a business meeting today. You know there's probably going to be a fist fight. And so he was delaying on doing this, and he knew the forces that were at work. In Akron, and it had a lot to do with the relationship of the Oxford group in Akron and the relationship of the Oxford group in New York. In Akron, it was one big family, and the alcoholics and the non-alcoholics all felt they were just one unit in the Williams home, and they'd have as many as 70 people in there. And it was very close-knit. And it was also, you got to the God thing the first night. I mean, you know, a new drunk would show up, and then he'd go upstairs with Dr. Bob and somebody else, and they'd go, do you believe in God? Okay, get down on your knees. We're going to start praying. I mean, there was no chance to sit there with God as I understand him. It was, you do know Jesus, don't you? Sit down here. There wasn't any doubt about who the higher power was out in Akron. And it's still a little that way that Akron, Cleveland still publishes the Four Absolutes as a pamphlet, which came that thing. And then in New York, they had a couple of people, Hank being one, and Jim Burwell, who were atheists, who after they hung around the Oxford group for a while, they slowly changed their mind and started going along with the God idea. So their experience told them that you should really save the God thing till later on and make the beginning of the introduction to AA sort of a psychological thing. Well, that's a big difference between Akron and New York. Here we got them. We don't want to talk about God till later, and out here they're going, no, we talk about him first. That's the first thing that happens. So there was this struggle going on about how to handle this God thing. And out of that struggle came God as we understand him. That was the compromise for the former atheists in New York And they went, okay, I can go along with that.
Do you attribute that phrase to Jim Brewer?
Yeah. Or to that argument that was going on. And it's funny you ask that, because if you study Bill's story, when Ebby is calling on him and Bill is showing resistance to the idea of God, Ebby says, well, why don't you come up with your own idea about God? So it was really there all the way back with Ebby, but that was forgotten when they were working on the book. And yes, I believe that it was Burwell, who was a pretty powerful guy and did a lot of wonderful work for AA. Philadelphia is Burwell's territory, Baltimore, and he helped out in Washington, D.C. And I'll tell you a thing about Burwell. He didn't believe that AA should have conferences. That was just his, no, we just have groups, we don't have anything beyond that. Philadelphia still doesn't have conferences. Bobby Coyle, some of you may know Bobby, speaks all over the place, and he decided to break the spell, the Burwell spell, and start a conference up there. And he started the Firecracker Roundup on 4th of July weekend. It lasted 2 years before the forces behind the scenes wiped it out. So it's amazing how the influence of whoever started AA in your area still can be carried forward. I mean, it is just amazing. No, we don't do it this way here. Why? I don't have any idea. And it goes, am I right? It goes all the way back to whoever started AA in Houston or Des Moines or whatever it is. And so that's how the compromise was reached, and the steps were circulated, and there was a lot of input that came into them, into how it works. And there was input on all of these, and some of from outside sources, outside of AA, and really from a psychiatrist who said, look, you really want to report these steps as in the past tense. We did this rather than you should do it. So it's shifted from the commandment type thing, which none of us would have listened to. And if you look at the big book and you knew, you're not in it. It's reporting about what we did. This is what we did. This is what we did. This is what we did. And then finally it says, and if you want what we have, this is how it's done. Nobody says you must do this. And that's a beautiful technique for keeping our attention, not driving us away in the beginning. So I'll just stop there with the influence that the two, and you know, that's still around, that New York versus Akron. It is just amazing.
Henry of Cyberling was always
a
strong believer that Bob did not get his due. That Bill was a promoter. Bill wrote most of the history of Alcoholics Anonymous, and it's probably just the way it is. But those two men never had a disagreement over anything as they went in. And, this joke always was, if Dr. Bob was the sole founder of AA, it would still be in Akron. If Bill was the sole founder, he would have sold it. And the only thing I want to say along with what Sandy talked about is, Bill had a strong tendency to depression. And today there's a lot of talk about depression. And the Akron group had 6 steps. And in one of Bill's kind of hypochondriacal thing, and he's got stomach trouble and he's in bed and he's down, he took a legal pad and took the 6 steps of the Oxford group in bed on not a very good day. And through Bill Wilson, God, they expanded them into the 12 steps. And when he was done, he liked the idea that there were 12. Kind of like that. That's a good number. And I mean, he knew that they needed to be expanded and address certain things that the Oxford group wasn't addressing, and tighten up a few things for the Drunks of Alcoholics Anonymous. But I think most of us, to me, the mark of great spiritual literature is that when you read it, it's always new. You think someone added something. Where did they put this in? And because of that, and because of the great impact that it had on our society, and because it's still the great impact that it's still having, I mean, almost everybody believes that Bill was an instrument. you know, that someone with his background, with his illness, with his short period of sobriety, he wasn't schooled in that way, couldn't have done it. But what a man, what a gifted writer. But what came through him on a bad day, not of himself, not something that he had been foisting himself. And I think sometimes we underestimate, you know, because we all have bad days. And sometimes it's, I don't know, I just love that he was almost not at his best. And that was the day he wrote the 12 Steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. We're going to take a break for 10 minutes, Sandy, or 15.
Okay.
How long?
Huh? I'm sorry.
How long do you want to take a break for, 10 or 15 minutes?
15.
Okay. 15 minutes.
All right, welcome back. We'll just pick up where we left off, continuing with the history around our book. They went to Cornwall Press, and everywhere they went, I left out the Reader's Digest story. That was that's a wonderful story. The final way that Bill was able to sell stock certificates was because of a visit that they made to the Reader's Digest offices. And they went up there and said, we're in the middle of, they told them all about AA, and Reader's Digest specializes in human interest stories, you know, that are going on affecting the country. And as he told this story to this assistant editor, he was very impressed. And they said, and our book is coming out, and this will be how alcoholics all over. So it's very important that the book be in the story. Oh, yeah, the book will be in the story. When you get that book finished, you just come up and tell us, and we'll be ready to go. And I think they had a circulation of 12 million readers. So when Bill came back to the drunks in the group, he said, hey, Reader Digest, 12 million. You guys, you better buy this because you're going to make a fortune. We're going to be selling millions of books out there. And so they did, and that helped push the sales up to keep the project going. And when they got the book to the printer, they went back to Reader's Digest and saw the same assistant editor, and they said, we're ready to go. I think his name was Canfield. Mr. Canfield, we're ready to shoot. He said, shoot what? He said, you remember we were up here a few months ago and we talked about that? He said, oh, yes, I remember that. And I thought it was such a wonderful idea, but when I talked to the top editor, he didn't like it at all, and I forgot to tell you. So they got nothing out of that. So you can see there was just one disappointment after another. But after the book came out, there was an article in Liberty Magazine in 1940, Alcoholics and God by Fulton Ousler, and that brought in a certain number of inquiries. But there was another event that happened at the same time that brought even more inquiries in, and the second one was an anonymity break by a baseball player on the Cleveland Indians. A catcher named Raleigh Helmsley, who caught Bob Feller, if anybody remember Bob Feller way back when, fastball pitcher. And the story about him is kind of fun. He was a really good athlete as a catcher. But as his drinking picked up, his performance started going down the tube. And the manager of the Cleveland Indians had heard about the Oxford group, and that they could get alcoholics sober. So he went to the local Oxford group in Cleveland and said, can you get my catcher sober? I'll pay you anything. And the Oxford group says, no, we don't take money. But the way for alcoholics right now to get sober, they go down to Akron to a hospital down there. That's where Dr. Bob was. They go through 5 days, and then they come into the group. And then we start working on them, and they get sober. And they say, oh, we can never talk them into going to the hospital. There's no way we can talk them into going to the hospital. So they came up with a plan where they had the opposing pitcher hit him.
Not seriously, but just a glancing blow. And the trainer ran out and went, "Oh my God, we got to take you to the hospital." And they took him down to Akron with this serious injury. And he found himself in the alcoholic ward. He got sober. He stayed sober and came back, and his performance started going up, up, up. And his performance got so good that the reporters started interviewing him. "What's going on? But now you're such a superstar, and you used to be, 'Oh, I joined Alcoholics Anonymous.'" And my batting average went up, and this went up, and it was in all the papers all over the country, and more inquiries came off of that anonymity break than the Liberty Magazine article.
And for a brief, just one aside, probably for the only time in Bill's career, Bill started to get jealous of Helmsley. And Bill started breaking his anonymity. And there was a period of about a year and a half where Bill was very present publicly. And he eventually was a strong proponent and turned down many opportunities to be very public about it. But this was a very brief thing, and Helmsley had a lot to do with
this.
With his ego.
And people got on Bill, and he finally slowed down. And our anonymity principle is still a wonderful thing. The next thing that caused a big flurry of activity was the Saturday Evening Post article by Jack Alexander, where AA had started to catch on, and Alexander was an investigative reporter that went in and found the true dirt on what was going on. You know, sure, they're out on the outside, they say they're doing good, but if I went in and investigated, I would find out there's something going on. Somebody's making money, there's something going on. So he was a suspicious reporter, and when he came in, they just embraced him, and he became one of AA's biggest fans. And he wrote an article in 1941, he wrote another one in 1950, a follow-up on AA, praising, etc. So there was a lot of inquiries came in off of the Jack Alexander article. Somebody would read it, they would mail him a big book, and then you would get sober from the book. We forget that a lot of early sobriety that in little cities all over the country, the AA got started because one drunk got a book, read it, got sober, and went out and found other alcoholics. So when you read our big book, you really should see that this is being written to someone who's going to do the steps by himself or herself. And then in step 12, and you know, working with others. Now comes the best part. Now you're going to go out and find drunks. Pretty soon a society will spring up around you. It sounds so glowing. Yeah, if you go get them. So when you're reading that part, you got to realize it's not going to spring up unless you go get them. So anyway, that helped a great deal. And then, out of the blue, Mr. Rockefeller called. And he had been following AA all these years, and he thought that it was just amazing. So he decided to throw a dinner in honor of Alcoholics Anonymous and invite all his big shop buddies in New York. And that's when Bill said, "Here is the money." Finally, after all these trials and tribulations, we're going to hit the jackpot. And so they had tables with the New York friends, and then at each table was one drunk who could tell his story to the people at the table. And that Irishman that we talked about that was on the Gabriel Hita show, Ryan, was at one table, and the people at the table said, "Well, Mr. Ryan, I assume you're in the banking business." He said, "No, I just got out of Greystone Sanitarium last night, but I'm back here." And then they'd listen to his story, and they were just fascinated with these drunks. You know, drunks don't have boring stories. So that caught on, and they were all fired up, and Bill gave a talk, and Dr. Bob, and Dr. Silkworth, and I don't know, a few others. And Mr. Rockefeller was sick, but his son Nelson came, and told why he invited, "This is the most wonderful thing, but I think money will ruin it. And so I'm going to just give them a little money to hold them over," and he gave something like $2,000. And so the rich guys went home and they said, well, he's almost a billionaire, and he gave 1,000. I'm just a millionaire. I'll give 10. But they did get some money from the people that were there, and they solicited that list for about 4 years. And at that point, they went back to Rockefeller, and they said, we're not going to ever ask for any money again. We're self-sufficient, and we're going to make it on our own. And that became the beginning of every group is self-sufficient. And Bill finally abandoned his idea that we got to get a lot of money. And before I turn over to Bob, there's Harper's and Saturday Evening Post were tremendous friends of AA. I mean, when the 12 and 12 came out and when AA Comes of Age came out, Bill gave Harper's special permission to print their own 12 and 12 and their own AA Comes of Age. And somebody, one of my friends in California, found me a copy of the one 12 and 12 from Harper's. And they were going to sell it to the libraries and places like that. So they had this real close relationship. That didn't prevent a total reversal in the 60s when an author named Kane, it's a site, psychologist, decided that AA was no good. And he wrote these long articles. One appeared in Saturday Evening Post and one appeared in Harper's Magazine, blasting AA. And so I wish I could get a copy of it, but one of the covers of the Saturday Evening Post, on the cover down in the bottom, said, AA is no good. And this is the magazine that. So it just shows you can't last forever. But those two articles, and that's when I got sober. The articles had just come out. AA, Cult or Cure, and Alcoholics Can Get Sober in Spite of AA. And this guy just had something that he didn't like about AA, and he wrote these two articles. They didn't have any effect, except it caused a lot of gossip in AA. We're going to get that guy. We're going to kill him. We're going to do that. Letters are going in and all that. And Bill wrote a grapevine article with his measured response, just saying, now, you know, we can learn a lot from our critics. Let's look and see. Maybe a couple of the points he makes are valid. And he really taught us the proper way to react to these things. So there's always great lessons, whether it's good news or bad news. So I'll stop there.
During this time, our experience, this is when Bill in the fellowship is kind of having all the experiences that we're eventually going to end up in our traditions. We talked about anonymity, we talked about no professionalism, we talked about self-support. My understanding was that AA paid back that money that they took over the 4 years from the dinners. But at any rate, it was a wonderful, the gift that Rockefeller gave us, just pause and think about the impact of money and our fellowship. Had we become a fellowship that owned property and was involved in a bunch of money, it never would have been. I mean, Rockefeller understood the pluses and the minuses of money. He understood what a volunteer, what a special thing it was, this word of mouth, sort of peer to peer. I mean, it's a design that has been copied. I don't know what, 300 organizations use our 12 steps. And copy, you know, for different issues in living. It's always striking to me that, I mean, here they have this little car polish company. They have the Alcoholic Foundation. It's just, you know, Ruth Hock is Bill's secretary. When the articles came out, when Ausler's article came out, we had 800 inquiries, and they answered them all by hand. When the Jack Alexander article came out, they had 8,000 inquiries. One employee, and they answered them all by hand by volunteers that came in the office and took the letters and handed them out. The impact of the book, when you talk about unity of our message, we were alive, you know, Bill got sober in 34, AA's founding is June the 10th, 1935, when Bob got sober. From June the 10th, 1935 to the writing of the book, we had in April of 39, we had 100 members of Alcoholics Anonymous. From April of 39 to 1940, to almost the end of 19, or to the beginning of 1941, We had 1,500 members. And with the Rockefeller dinner, with the Saturday Evening Post, with the publishing of the book, at the end of 1941, we had 8,000 members of Alcoholics Anonymous. Now, having something to send out to show someone what our program was and how it worked, and it was, you know, I mean, the difference in that, I mean, Bill's, you know, what Smitty, what Dr. Bob's son used to talk about, his father saying, is that Bill could see further down the road than any man he ever met. Mm-hmm. And almost everything that Bill's been through a few fights, you know, in the fellowship, be it the majority of trustees being alcoholic rather than non-alcoholic, and people thought we'd blow ourselves apart. And there were a couple of things that Bill Wilson wanted to get done before he died. And he pushed and had a big fight about it. But Bill Wilson was a visionary. And if you would, and I think in our fellowship, it's important that at some point in time, I don't know if we need a better history book, because AA Comes of Age is a hard book to read. And Not God is probably one of the best history books we have, but that's a PhD thesis by Ernie Kurtz. But I really do believe if we had an interesting way, and Not God is an interesting book, to access our history and see the context in which these traditions were brought up, and the context and the wonderful story about how the book was written and all the different players in it, I think we'd have a much larger appreciation for how unique we are, and what powerful spiritual principles guided us to reach. And I was going to talk about it a little bit more this afternoon, but I want to raise it right now. Mm-hmm. I want you thinking about it. So the idea that God had to be the answer, that is spiritual side had to be an answer for this illness, was a very new idea. Now, there have been people that have been trying to cure all sorts of things on a symptomatic basis with religion. But this was aimed specifically at alcoholics, by alcoholics. And they, number one, said we had a disease. And the disease was kind of unusual in that, you know, we, with the phenomenon of craving, that we had this physical malady. But we also had this quirk of mind that, you know, destined us to our own thinking, we're always going to return to drinking. And so you got a fatal disease, and you can't not on your own. You can't deal with it. You're going to die. And but the disease is physical, but it's also mental and spiritual. And that the solution has to have a strong spiritual component, or you're not going to get well. I mean, this is very new. But I think what's even a little bit more unique. We are, as a society, we're an oral society. And as a society, we have one of the best BS detectors that you will find. In a meeting, or when someone's giving a talk, we have enormous tolerance for whatever the person says, if it's truly of them. But when they start preaching, or teaching, or getting intellectual, or quoting someone else, or talking about a third party longer than a minute or something, we don't have much time for it. I mean, because it is, so I think what is, one of the things that is unique and ended up being one of our great treasures in Alcoholics Anonymous, not just that we needed a spiritual solution, the combination of us telling our stories, needing a spiritual solution, and not tolerating any other way of sharing it other than sharing your experience, strength, and hope. Not your philosophy, not your theology, not the rules, not what someone should, not your beliefs. We want your experience. Well, if you look today at what most religious movements are examining themselves about, they're examining themselves, they're saying that for the last 30 or 40 years to be a prominent member of our church organization, almost all the attention was on what you believed. And we feel today that the real power of religion is in the transformative power of that religion, to be engaged in a relationship with a power greater than yourself in such a way that it can transform and change and improve your life in a very real way. Well, that would describe pretty much our organization. So it wasn't just that they had to find God, because you could move towards finding God by reading books. They didn't do that at all. They wanted to surrender and understand that you had to find a power greater than yourself. And then when you found a power greater than yourself, you had to, it had to be an experience, not just an idea, not just a belief. And that's kind of the only way we listen to each other. We don't give a darn what you believe. We don't get what your theology is. We want the sharing of your experience. Now that is, I mean, I really think in many ways we are, how many clergy have we had come to our rooms and say they've reclaimed their spirituality in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous because of this pithy conversation we have, a real conversation about God and how we're related to God. You know, not if he was married, not if he had children, not if his, you know, mother had any more children. We don't care about any of the theology that the other movements do. So I think in a way that gift, I think, and it's been emulated and copied, is extraordinary. Extraordinary. We've been forced into a relationship with our higher power that is experiential, personal. And today, that's at the growing point of most spiritual movements. That's where everybody wants to be. They're getting off of theology and into the realness of the relationship. Yes.
Thanks, buddy.
Give me a water, man.
Oh, you need a glass. I can supply that too. I wouldn't make a good waiter. Too impatient. Well, let's see. You remind me of something, which is the role of the big. One of the fears that Bill had was that the big book would become biblical, that it would take on the attributes of a Bible, something sacred, something that contains all the answers, something that you go to when you have problems. Now, why would he worry about that? Well, people had told him that, showed him in writings where they did studies of spiritual organizations, that when they took their principles and laid them down in writing, the writing became sacred. It just was the way human nature is. And so, instead of worshiping God, you worship a book. Instead of going to God for answers, you go to a book for answers. And the big book is a treasure map, but it's not the treasure. The treasure is God. It takes you to God. There's the jackpot. This is not the jackpot. And you'll notice that when he wrote the third and seventh step prayers, in both cases he says, you could say something like this. He didn't even want those words to become cast in concrete, worshipped, adored, and all of that, which they are. They're printed on plastic, and they're have saved more lives than whatever. And in both of them, he said, you could make up your own, just something like this. This is the thing. And so it's important to realize that these are principles, and the principles will cause us to have a spiritual awakening. And the spiritual awakening is the point of all the principles. And once you have this awakening, we have this contact established with God, then we just keep improving the contact. How do I make it deeper? How do I continue? How do I do that? And it's when you study I read a lot of spiritual history and spiritual books outside of AA, which AA encourages me to do. there's both the 12 and 12 in the big book, says, go to the library. They're filled with wonderful books about spirituality. Talk to ministers. Talk to outside people. They'll give you all kinds of ideas on how to improve your relationship with AA. It'll help you see the third step in a greater depth. Doesn't take you out of AA, but it's designed to increase this. And there's a thing called spiritual pride. And it's the damnedest thing. One of the problems with spirituality is it works. It actually makes you happier. It fills you with joy. It's just the most wonderful thing in the world. And that's what it's supposed to do. It lifts you up into a new world. When you open your eyes and you look out, you see a world that you're very comfortable in. And it's absolutely wonderful. But our friend the ego isn't sitting by just allowing this to happen. It helps us look at this differently. And it convinces us that we are now a much better person than we were when we came in. See, we're not being held up there by God any longer. We can hold ourselves up there. We are a better person. I am now this kind of a person. And so my need for God, oddly enough, is reduced by the success that I have. And I actually have the feeling that I'm not as desperate as when I first came in, which is just the opposite of the program, because we want to get more desperate by turning more things over so that we become more dependent. But this thing called spiritual pride has a tendency to do this. And so we can end up totally absorbed in God's work and leave God out. We can do this with 12-step work. I'm totally committed. I 12-step. I've got somebody I'm working with every single day. And nothing ensures immunity from drinking like working with other alcoholics. That assures immunity from drinking, not spiritual growth. Immunity from drinking. And so I remember there was a period of 5 years, if I didn't have 20 guys, I'm just going and going, and I'm starting to get irritated inside. These guys are taking too much of my time. They're really bugging me. This is, why am I doing this? These are just regular guys that I'm working with. My connection with God has been put aside because I'm doing God's work. You see how tricky it is? Because it looks good. And your friends will go, boy, you're a hell of an AA member. I'm really proud of you. Look at how hard you're working. Blah, blah, blah. And then all of a sudden somebody explodes at a meeting and you're, what happened? He was just doing so much work. So we always have to keep in mind that the goal is God. And one of the last principles of the Oxford movement is one that we don't follow as strongly as they did. And that was that you would seek God's guidance on just about everything you were going to do. I mean, it just became an absolute way of life. Let me think about it. Let me reflect. Let me see what God wants me to do. And then I would ask somebody else. I sat quietly for quite a while. I feel that this is where I'm being guided. What do you think? And there's this type of process. And I think we shortcut that a lot. I know I do. I come up with, well, this sounds good to me. I'll run it by Bob. And he says, yeah, that sounds good. So it's probably a good plan. But God was left out. And it was, the way we do that is we become familiar with God and what his plan is. And we just assume that we know it. And that it's not going to change in various circumstances, even though they're similar to the one last year, we may be going to get different guidance on this one. And so it's a real challenge to not allow dogma to overtake us. I remember when Bob Pearson retired from the New York office, that was one of his fears, that AA would get rigid. You remember that? He gave a talk on rigidity. And that we would suddenly, this is the way.
It is moving in that direction.
Huh?
It is moving in that direction.
Oh, okay. Well, I don't want to accuse I'll let you do it. He's expressing exactly how I feel. I just didn't want to step on any toes, so. Bob, you take over here.
Okay.
So I get to be the jerk. It's, all human organizations move towards orthodoxy. I don't care if it's a church organization, a government organization. They start to want conformity into how people think. We are a large movement. And as such, I think that we will see and have seen a tendency within our society to have kind of arch conservatism. You know, there'll be groups that are, you know, more conservative, more structured, more brittle, you know, that they feel they have a, you know, a kind of a handle on what's right and what's wrong, what the book says, what the book doesn't say. We do it right. If you're not, you're going to, you know, go to hell. I grew up in a religion that was something like that. And in that comes the spiritual pride sort of thing, that it is, you know, we do it right and you do it wrong. And it is, that's a very non-AA, in my opinion. In the 40 years I've been around, that is not a broad attitude. And you will see it more in the franchise groups, you know, because they're copying, you know, they have a strong influence and they're taking an idea of someone, of a leader, and trying to interpret that. And I think there's a, you know, and on the other hand, most of those groups have some of the strongest sponsorship that we see in the country. The meetings are more interesting than most places that you go, so they're... It isn't like the constructionist groups don't have great qualities, you know, to serve them. But I think for the individuals and for the leaders over a period of time, I think what Sandy was talking about, spiritual growth, is stunted by too much concentration on form. And because of God, the idea that I do it correctly and you don't is a thought that we have to be somewhat careful of, because there's like an ownership. It's like I've got the franchise, you know, God spoke to me. Well, he didn't speak to me, he spoke to my sponsor. And, or to my sponsor's sponsor. And I just think there's a, when we run into that kind of thinking in any other arena, we don't like it. When we run into it in the hard shell churches, and you get the impression, you know, that one of your neighbors or your sister just got, you know, inducted into it, and they come over to the house to tell you that you have now been judged sorry. And, no, but that's kind of the approach, even though it's an act of love, and they really want, I mean, there is a message that you don't have what I have, and you're in need of what I have, and I just think there ought to be, we need to be aware of the movement towards orthodoxy, and the use of the book, like the Bible is being used. The book is the menu, it is not the food. You can starve to death eating the menu. And there are a lot of people who know the book better than I do that, you know, may even in some cases have it memorized that I would not go on a fishing trip with. I mean, there, you know, it is... Memorizing 164 pages does not guarantee spiritual growth. And it is much more important about how we put those into action in our lives and how we live them. And all of us live them imperfectly. But that is where I think the essence of it is. I'm done being a jerk. You can go back.
Now, the reason this is interesting is I've been there. I'm not talking about, you know, I saw this somewhere over there. I can remember a 10-year period, and and there was something nice about certainty. You know what I mean? If you could lay it out dogmatically, this is it. This, then you have a certainty thing. And there is no certainty in life. And there's no, Kurtz wrote another book, The Spirituality of Imperfection. We just have to accept that we don't know everything and that there is no guaranteed way of doing anything, but it feels good if you have it. Do you understand what I'm saying? It gives you a comfort feeling to go, there it is, type, 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 laid out this way. If you say these words to the person you're sponsoring regarding step one, you're going to get results beyond anything you've ever seen. Do you follow what I'm saying? And you go, wow, I love this. I love the comfort of certainty. And then I just ended up getting very angry because nobody else was doing it. And I wasn't relying on God at all. I was relying on typewritten pages of information. So I'm just speaking from my own experience. Now, when you go back in history, you got to realize that when AA was brand new, there was a tendency to do this. Clarence Snyder up in Cleveland typed up all kinds of instructions on how to do the steps. He wrote the first, all the pamphlets and how to take meetings to jails, how to take meetings to hospitals, what you do with a new person. It was really laid out because it's brand new and you think you might have to do that. Cincinnati did it. Akron did it. And if you go online, you can find these early instructions that were laid out in different parts of the country on precisely how to sponsor someone, precisely how to do this. What happens is, 70 years later, somebody gets a copy of that and forms a group around it, and you now have the official way. And the official way produces much higher results. Have you all been involved in this? That the old way, there was a much higher percentage of people got sober. And today we have atrocious levels. And fortunately, there was two or three guys down in Texas who put a paper out that the ratio is exactly the same today as it was back in the 40s. Because the counting has to be done on people who sincerely try the program, not people who were bussed there by a treatment center. There were 100 people at the meeting and only two of them got sober. So the percentage today is really terrible. And anyway, these are just things. And also in some of the groups back then, I know in Cleveland, I think in Akron, especially in Cleveland, in order to get in the group, you had to have taken all the steps, you had to have a sponsor, and you had to have three people vouch for you. Now, if you start with that as a starting point, your recovery rate's going to be pretty high. You know what I mean? If you're just measuring success based on people who've already done this, so you're going to go, look, we're getting 90% people are getting sober here. Yeah, I understand that. If we did that before you could get in my group, our numbers would go up. So anyway, these things are around, and they're probably fun for a while. But I go back to the final paragraph in the big book. Our book is meant to be suggestive only. We realize we know only a little. So if all the experts that wrote the big book know only a little, then there's only a little in the book. And where does all the rest come from in the next sentence? God will constantly disclose more to us if your house is in order. You can't transmit something you don't have. So the thing that is really being hammered home inside of me is how important contact with God is. That's where the answers are. That's where the comfort is. That's where the intuitive guidance comes from. And as much as I love the comfort of dogma, it makes you feel like you're safer. It lets you down in the final analysis. Or am I wrong, Bob? Waiting for him one time to go, you're totally wrong, and then go off on another
tangent. I think it's obvious.
Huh?
Being right is a booby prize. It really is. I mean, as we say amongst ourselves, you can either be in a relationship or you can be right. And the people who, in spirituality or religion or Alcoholics Anonymous or science or anything else, that are right, and in the process make others wrong, to me just aren't as effective. And it isn't a matter of good guys and bad guys. It's a matter, I mean, everybody who's actively significantly doing 12-step work is trying to help people. They're really using the expression of, and I think it's a, I don't know what it is. I think some of us are more attracted to things that are black and white, or we're more attracted to things that tend to feel like they make us wrong and someone else right. I think that the ego loves being in the in-group. You know, the ego loves believing that we have something that no one else has. And in the Midwest, we always get a little of that because the people on the East and West Coast kind of feel like they kind of own it and invented it and have something that no one else has. And I keep wondering what we have. And it's there's less certainty in it, and there's less comfort in it if you really believe, as Sandy talked about, and I believe that being open to God directing, that there is more than one way to do 12-step work, that there is, you know, that the book is interpretive. You know, I mean, the Bible, I mean, that's the great argument that most of the fundamental churches have. It's either direct, you know, it either says exactly, it's literal, and then there's an equal number of people that say, no, it's not literal, it's poetic. I mean, it is God, we think it's inspired, but it's not literal. And, you know, that argument goes on. And we are an evolving fellowship. And we will see the impact of this, you know. And we're now at a time when our founders are dead. And most of the old-timers, most of the people that were my heroes, and certainly the two that you mentioned, were amongst them. I mean, there's only a handful of people that are of that generation that, you know, that are the 50-year-old sober, you know, men and women that are around, and they're not going to be around for long. My sponsor has 55 years of sobriety. He's 90 years old. He was visiting his 95-year-old sister at Christmas, who's 57 years sober, and he fell down the basement stairs and broke his arm. And he was in a nursing home for 2 months, and he's the worst patient in the world. And he is now home, and he was at the meeting last Monday night, and you know, it's just great. And we, you know, and all of us who are involved in doing this work have a great love for our fellowship. We feel like, you know, like our fellowship and this message and the heritage that's being presented to us has saved our lives and saved our children's lives and saved our parents' lives. And, you know, as David talked about last night, you know, my wife and I, I said both of us. I was going to say I have three sons. We. I have a pronoun problem. We have three boys that are in the program. When you have, you know, when you've been given that kind of recovery, you know, the gratitude is endless. You know, so we're all trying to do a good job. But I think that spirituality in general does not have the black and white certainty. And it speaks lovingly and generally more softly. And it isn't like you can't be strong. And it isn't like you can't confront. And it isn't like there aren't times where you have to take difficult actions. But it's so enough, I guess, sit on that.
Where are we time-wise, then?
It's 10:45. We're going to be done at 11:30, so yeah. What you want to do? You want to take a 5-minute break and come back and do questions? 10-minute break.
Question, just raise your hand and the microphone will come out there. Okay. And that way everybody can hear. And if the questions are hard, Bob answers them. If they're easy, I answer.
What
Well, there were like six steps in the Oxford group, which had to do with inventory and admitting surrender, finding God, work, doing restitution, and working with others.
And getting guidance.
And, you know, so those were generally the six, forerunner of the steps. It's what the early members of Alcoholics Anonymous used. They also used the four absolutes, but they very much used the six forerunners of the steps, you know, in the operation. And what they were, you know, they when you went over a lot of the meetings, like the meetings at T. Henry and Curtis Williams' house, you had to take a step three or make a decision before you could join the group, the squad, the alcoholic squad, or the action group. You know, so my understanding, and I just recently reread some of that, is that those were the six steps, and that's what Bill expanded and changed a little bit, and that's what gave us the outline of, I mean, not the outline, but gave us our 12 steps.
Did that answer it? Okay. Wow.
I'm Doug from Spencer Island. Sandy, I heard you, on one of your CDs, talk about the importance of contact with God. Can you just talk more about that?
Well, one of the things I would comment on that is probably the things that's helped me the most with that is outside literature. In other words, you decide you want to find how to meditate better, how to establish contact, how to seek guidance. And granted, the prayer of St. Francis is a powerful beginning in the 12 and 12. As a matter of fact, I ran across a meditation book that's entirely on the prayer of St. Francis, where you just focus on each line in the prayer of St. Francis and see what that means to you and try to understand the power that's contained in that prayer. And one of the things I ran across that I found very good for beginners, it seems that the ego will allow us to take four breaths before it wants to know what's going on. And interrupt, you know how when you try to meditate and you're sitting quiet, hey, what about this? You ought to be working on the budget and you're little on it. And I've done it many, many times so that during the day, if you can't do anything else, you're at work or any place you are, you can stop and just take four breaths and focus on it, just in and out, and you'll be left alone. You have this moment of peace. I don't know how long that is. It's probably 25 seconds or something like that. But if you do it often enough during the day, it could add up to the equivalent of 30 minutes of meditation. And since meditation creates space, it creates a bigger environment for us to be in so that we're not cramped by it. All the problems of the world, that amount of space gets added and you have a sense of comfort from a very simple thing like that. But the main thing that's helped me is outside literature and classes. You know, just looking, there's a neighborhood thing and you just go. And because we get just a cursory, there isn't much in the big book at all. And then in the 12 and 12, the prayer of St. Francis, and of course that is very powerful. So that's my experience. Bob, what about you, sir?
Thanks, Sandy. I have had a kind of a dicey year. I'm in the real estate business, and things. I have a number of circumstances that aren't what I'd like them to be. It's an invitation for obsession. My mind, you know, if my mind were to drift, it would go towards what's not the way I want it to be and what might I be able to do about it. what I mostly do in Alcoholics Anonymous is try to maintain my spiritual condition. How do I maintain my spiritual condition? I go to 5 meetings a week. I go to church a couple of times a week. I go to my sponsor's house. I work with guys and I do different things. Right. So right now, I've simplified my life. I've kind of got my head down. And I do something daily, mostly meetings, to kind of remind me about who I am and what it's about. Because at meetings, there's lots of people with difficulty. I'm not the only person with a difficulty. In my house, you know, I'm the one with the problem, and it, you know, it's more prominent, and I can, and I know you're not supposed to be self-centered, but I'm fascinated. So if the
I want a copy of this tape.
I'll tell you something. I mean, as you get older, I mean, if you came to Sandy or I and you were really upset about something, the mere fact you were upset about something is that you're, you know, you're not as God-centered, and that's what I do with myself. So when I'm upset, I'm looking for something to read, for someone to talk to, for something to do that moves me towards being reconnected. And that's what I mean, it's a very simple, relatively, you know, thing to do. Just axiomatically, I think if you went to old-timers who are really trying to practice their program, is we would use the idea of if you're upset, something's wrong. Calm down. Get, you know, kind of focused. So that's what I do to that. I mean, I also meditate and I pray, but I'm just talking on a daily basis.
Great. Uh-oh, this is going to be tough. No.
He didn't seem that bright to me. Are you worried about that?
As you were talking about the history, where would you rate Father Dowling and
Well, Shoemaker, of course, provided the location for the Oxford group to meet in New York at his church. And I think had a great influence on many of the early AAs. I don't know if Bill was that close with him as he was with Father Dowling. And I'll tell you, I was going to come up with a question. This is a real obscure trivia question. And it involves him. And the question is, we have a sentence in our big book that says, you can't transmit something you don't have. Now, there was an example of this in AA history between two people. Neither one of them was in AA, but a very similar sentence was said. And Shoemaker was on the receiving end of it. And on the giving end was Frank Buckman, the head of the Oxford group. And they were in Africa, and Shoemaker was having no success trying to help the people that he was with. And he was asking Buckman about it. And he said, well, if you don't have anything they want to listen to, they're not going to listen. So there's something wrong inside of you. And boy, he took a big offense to that. But later on, he said that's what caused his whole awakening, where he suddenly wanted to get guided by God. But because he said you can't transmit something. He was trying to transmit something that he didn't really have. And then when Father Dowling showed up in the clubhouse in New York, he had heard about AA and he wanted to find more about it, and he and Bill just hit it off. Bill thought it was some drunk from out of town. He was tired. He was upstairs sleeping up in the clubhouse, and the two of them really hit it off. So much so that Bill, in his later years, actually considered converting to Catholicism. And he studied it. Fulton Sheehan was one of his answers, and but he never could accept completely that Christ was God also, was man and was God. Down he just couldn't make that leap. But the big thing that he felt, he said if he converted, it would probably just screw AA up big time. You know what I mean? Well, I guess if the leader converted, then we all should. And if we don't convert, we're not as good AAs. And so I think he did a blessing there. Anything I left out?
Not leaving out. I think Shoemaker was a very important man to Bill. I think it was hard when they made the break. I think it was hard on the relationship for both men, but Bill asked him at the 1955 conference to speak. You know, he was one of the one of the founding supportive people. So obviously, you know, Dowling in the early 40s, Dowling was clearly Bill's spiritual advisor, and Bill started going to Thiebaud twice a week. He would go to Dr. Thiebaud as a psychiatrist, and people were upset by that. They didn't think he should do that. They thought it was a bad example. But I think it's wonderful for a couple of reasons. Is number one, that he could get support and help and act like, you know, he's telling us we should act. And I think if most of us would say that the tone of the 12 and 12, you know, is different specifically in his treatment of the fourth step and in 6 and 7, and I think most of us can see the hand of a Jesuit in some of it, if you have some familiarity with that. And other people think Powers, who was a, you know, kind of a close man with Bill, who did some of the editing of Bill's writings, thought Tom Powers had his finger in it a little more heavily than people would have wanted. As they say, I marvel. I think most people kind of think that God wrote the big book and Bill wrote the 12 and 12 in his office. You know, I mean, they have a different, you know, the more constructionist, you know, kind of feel the big book is more real than the 12 and 12. But I have a real affection for the 12 and 12, as I know Sandy does. And listening to a man who started to write those essays when he was 10 years sober and having a different, you know, and seeing things differently, and his emphasis is different, and some of the importance. I think it's healthy and wonderful for us to have both those things available to us. I think Dowling was Bill was a lonely man. Bill and Bob were never allowed to be members of the fellowship, ever. I mean, he couldn't sit in a meeting. I mean, he had one group that he could go to that approximated that. So think of the loneliness of the man, you know, when he said to, when they passed it over in 55 or 50, you know, they said, now maybe we can join. They said that to each other. But they couldn't.
Yeah, I guess my question is something that Bob was earlier about leaning more towards thinking their group is the only group the right way or the wrong way. And for me, it was, I hear a lot at my KBSAA that the old timers back then would more or less. Man, you get in the car, we're going here, we're going there. It seemed to work, and you can't do that today. They don't want to listen. And then I hear a lot of the phrase, is the message being watered down today? And where did that come from?
I think that's got some valid points in there, that the God aspect is less. And we live in a different society than came into AA in the 40s. In the 30s and 40s, probably everybody in the country went to church. And the vast majority of them went to Christian churches. And so to talk about God was just so common. But in society today, the word God is not received as kindly as it was back then. I was helping a gal having a terrible time getting sober because she just couldn't deal with the God thing. And she had just graduated about 5 years earlier from Harvard. And she said that her peers would just take her apart if she ever said anything about God. That it was just so out of fashion. So out of peer pressure, she just had to eliminate even thinking about that. And then she came in here, and here we are saying, no, you're going to have to get comfortable with, oh, well, what if my class finds out? You follow what I'm saying? So it's a whole different environment. So it's up to us that understand that without God there is no AA to make sure that we never compromise on talking about the importance of God. That there is no program without God. This is
it's not an easy conversation to have in our society today.
No,
it is.
But we'll kill a lot of alcoholics if we try to find a way.
And it's the only. And I don't think AA is being watered down. As a matter of fact, I think these people that are talking about back to basics, you know, that we're back to doing the things that we always used to do. I mean, the impression I get, I came in 67, we're using the big book 5 times as much as we used it in the early days. I mean, it just was not used as effectively taking people through the book in a more formal way. I think there's more of that happening. I think sponsorship is every bit as strong. But one of the main differences, I was at a little deal last weekend, and one of the doctors, Burns B., presenting, he said, one of the differences today is, he said, when I came in, there were 30 old-timers over 5 years for every new guy. Today, there's 30 new people for every old-timer. So, I mean, the group I came into, the meeting I went into, I mean, there were like 25 or 30 people. They were all quite a bit older. They all had a fair amount of sobriety. And I was a new person in the group. For, I don't know, 4 months, 5, there weren't new people coming in every day. You got a heck of a lot of attention in that process. And that business about getting the car, that's a personality thing. There are people today who have the personality that can tell someone to get in the car and someone gets in the car. The rest of us, if we were to copy that, it doesn't sound right. I mean, it isn't me, so if it's you, it still works, so.
Well, there's and growing pains are just part of any society you belong to, and we're in a big one now. It's bigger and bigger and bigger, and so you're going to get things. I use the example of political correctness, and suddenly that's finding its way into AA, but. If we apply that too far, we're going to have people dying because we're not telling them, we're going to have to hurt their feelings if we're going to tell them the truth. You can't couch it and, I'm sorry, if that offends you, we won't do it in our group. Well, when I was new, there's a lot of things that offended me about AA. I didn't know that if you said offend, that you've got a special treatment. Because not drinking offended me. And I'm very glad they didn't go, we can't offend him, so let's not talk about not drinking and let's not do this. And so we got to be very careful to not, this is just my own personal opinion, but in some groups, they got rid of the Lord's Prayer because someone didn't like it.
It's a big deal all over the country.
Now, that's the worst reason for getting rid of it. You got a new person that doesn't like it, so we change it. So what are we teaching that person? Self-centeredness works. If you demand that AA adjusts to you, it will. Well, the program says, we're going to show you how to adjust to the world, and then you'll be happy. But the world isn't going to adjust to you all the time. And so what a terrible lesson to show to a new person that if you don't like something, we'll change it.
That's wonderful.
Do you follow what I'm saying? That could get them drunk. Now, on the other hand, if the group had another reason, maybe, they suddenly looked around and they said, hey, 80% of the people in our group are Jewish. Why don't we learn the Jewish prayer and say it? That would be a good reason for changing. Do you follow what I'm saying? Because they all wanted to do something exciting and new. It wasn't because somebody didn't like it. That's just so terrible. I don't like this. There's too much talk about the steps. It offends me. We'll talk more about the steps.
I mean, it's just, that's the lesson. The whole spiritual program is to show how to adjust. You get the power to adjust to whatever's happening. And then events have no effect on your peace of mind. And that's a very powerful thing to have. And so that's just my 2 cents worth on that.
You talked a little bit of, made a statement, one of the statements that I heard in the earlier session was that somebody felt that Dr. Robbins went through. And what I'd like to hear is a little bit about Evan and the relationship between Will and Bob and Evan. With the showing of the TV program, it was just on. You see that they were really close and that they had an extended relationship, and I've heard stories about what has happened with that. Please tell us a little bit about that.
Okay. You want to do it, Bob? I've been talking too much.
No, you haven't. that's one of the most wonderful things. You are one of my heroes, and being with you is a joy. I'll say a few things, and I'd like Sandy to correct me, because I'm not a... Yeah, they were boyhood friends. They... I'm not even with Manchester, but he went up and Ebby's family summered in one of the cottages up there where Bill lived, and they were friends, and then drank. He was one of Bill's early drinking companions. So they were close kind of all the way through, and Ebby's brother. Bill referred to Ebby. Ebby never had a hell of a lot of sobriety. A year and a half or 2 years when he died, he had a couple of periods where he had a couple of years. I remember one group from Texas drove up in an automobile to New York, and, cornered Bill, and they were at a meeting. They said, let's go to New York. Got in a goddamn car. And, that's Texas, I think. And, it is. I mean, that's more likely that could happen in a lot of bars, but I mean, that is. And when they were done with that, they looked over and they said to Bill, is there anything we can do for you? And he said, yeah, will you take another crack at Ebby? And so they went and found him, and he was in really bad shape, and they took him back to Texas for, 6-8 years?
Yeah, he had a lot of sobriety near the end.
And he went down there with Searcy in a group, and they really focused a lot of attention. It was probably the best period of time he had in his life. Bill referred to Ebby as his sponsor his entire life. And Ebby, and I'm going to say, this sounds kind of sad, but if you heard Ebby, I've only heard one thing, one talk of Ebby's in the conversations. It's like he didn't get it. It's like he didn't get it. He didn't understand the miracle. I mean, he would say things like, I've been mostly sober. I've had much more sobriety than not. I mean, he didn't seem to understand the wonder of which he was a seminal part of. And,
well, one of the big things is that his spiritual transformation was big when he joined the Oxford group and had an awakening. It was so big that's what convinced Bill to try it. It wasn't anything that he said, it's the way he looked. Because Bill knew he was a mess, and this guy sitting across the table from him, Bill kept staring at him to make sure it wasn't a double or something, because his entire energy was different. He was a different person. But he didn't maintain that. So you can have a very powerful spiritual awakening, and if you don't maintain it, it can go south.
It devolves.
You know what I mean? And but he played a very important role, there's no doubt about it, and Dr. Bob knew him and respected the role that he played, and they worked so hard to try and keep him sober. Bill would introduce him at conferences, the Long Beach International Convention, my sponsor, Ebby, and I mean, he just wanted, I think he wanted history to look kindly on Ebby, and it's... You know what I mean? You're bringing up the question. He played such an important role, and he probably was a good example for how not to do it. You know, that you look and you just go, boy, you can be right in there. You can be Bill's best friend.
And still, if you don't maintain your contact, fall, you're going to go down. So there was, I'm glad you brought his name up. It's a huge piece of our history.
We have time for one last question. Ron here, Bob. I think we're just saying, I didn't say that terminated, so I'll throw that out first. But second thing is, we have something coming up very soon, and it's the international. It's going to be San Antonio in July. And if you don't know about it, it's a really big deal. The last one was in Toronto, and it was unbelievable, and I can only imagine how big San Antonio is going to be. Could you maybe speak on the upcoming international and how those have played a role in AA's history? And a three-part question, I'm sorry. International growth in the future in places like India and China. That
here's the expert.
Oh, yeah. That's because you don't want to answer the question. The fastest growth in Alcoholics Anonymous is in other parts of the world. I have been to meetings in Beijing and Hong Kong. I have been in meetings in Mumbai and in India. India has a good grounding in Alcoholics Anonymous. China is growing. It doesn't yet have the traction. It's funny, when AA is growing around the world, one of the big problems they have, especially in Eastern Europe, is the people who are... we were so blessed, like the United States. When the United States had people like Ben Franklin and Thomas Jefferson, and, you know, I mean, we had these bright, educated men who were the second sons of families that, you know, came over here to, you know, because they weren't going to inherit their thing, and they were over here seeking their... And when we started this country, we had some wonderful people to step up to design our democracy. When we designed Alcoholics Anonymous, I mean, Richardson and Rockefeller, and I mean, Leonard Strong, and I mean, the different people that we had, they were wonderful non-alcoholic. So you go to these Eastern European countries, they're more low-bottom drunks. They don't have, you know, in many, many of the early 100 people we had were kind of the black sheep of good families, you know, that were educated and principled and, you know, had a sense of that. And so when you go to a place and you're trying to establish a general service office and, you know, most of the guys or gals are low bottom and don't have much sense of organization, and then not being able to attract the right kind of class A trustees, you have a little trouble doing that. I don't think internationals have played a hell of a role since 1955 in Alcoholics Anonymous. I think they're a celebration, and I don't think they've been very seminal. I don't think much is, I mean, in 1950 we passed the traditions, and in 1955 we came of age and we formalized the general service structure of Alcoholics Anonymous. With that exception, I can't think of anything earth-shattering that we've done at international, and I think the one in San Antonio will be very interesting and quite wonderful.
I should keep my mouth shut.
Please.
In 1980, I was asked to speak at one in New Orleans, and I spoke in the Superdome, and it was a big deal, and I really, oh boy, this is really wonderful.
I was there.
And that was Marty's last talk. And it's, you know, wow, it's mind-blowing, and all these people holding hands, saying the Lord's Prayer. It's probably the most powerful thing in the world, until somebody came along and decided we won't say the Lord's Prayer anymore. So if you're going to go, say the Lord's Prayer no matter what they tell you to say. When you think about it, 70,000 people. Now, I don't know how to do the percentage real fast on AA's 4 million, but it's a very tiny percentage that can afford to go and that do go. And so it's fun. It's a chance to sort of get some publicity, the local town, the newspapers. But as far as substance happening, it happens in your group. All of AA action occurs up to the intergroup level. And then there's things happen above that that sometimes have value, but we do get pamphlets changed and things like that. I'm just saying.
Well, you can be a jerk too.
See, Bob is the delegate and going to run the New York office. And we don't see eye to eye on things above the group. AA is the groups, and the message is carried one alcoholic to another, and so 99% of everything is the group and the intergroup.
No question.
And then this becomes, there are some issues that require heavy-duty thinking by the staff and the trustees and the delegates. My final thing, just to express my views, at conventions where they introduce former delegates, I think they should also introduce former coffee makers. Thank you.
He got more applause. But I think you need it. And, so, the subject of this afternoon's workshop, and we're going to do a workshop for about 45 minutes, come back, talk for 15 minutes, and then have questions and answers. I've been sober since December of 67. And as my friends who know me since high school and grade school would come up and say, why are you still going to Alcoholics Anonymous? You haven't had a drink in 42 years. You know, why do you have to keep going to meetings? And I say, well, I have a gift for being a jerk. And when I attend meetings on a regular basis, I'm not quite as big a jerk. And but it's where I maintain my spiritual condition. I don't know why I have such a dense mind. I don't know why it's so busy. I don't know why it's so negative. I don't ask for those things, but it's been very busy and very negative since I've been a young guy. And I think we all have different internal conversations. I'm one of seven kids. My brothers and sisters don't seem to have quite as dense. We have a few, we have one member and one, maybe a potential member in that group, but they just don't have as heavy a mind as I do. And I look at my bride. My wife is, kind of a naturally healthy person, and I'm just more intense. You know, I'm climbing mountains to try to have the spiritual experience she has just living her daily life. You know, I've got to read the right books and do the right exercises and stuff like this. And so the subject was going to be, was kind of ongoing surrender. And the thing that opens us up to, you know, we've been talking about things spiritual, and the choice is, as Chuck Chamberlain used to say, you can either have a God-centered life and suffer the consequences, or you can have a self-centered life and suffer the consequences. That's a pretty big choice. Life is very different when you're God-centered and very different when you're self-centered. If you're talking to someone who's having a fight with their wife, a serious fight about whether they think they want to stay married, that conversation is a very different conversation when there's no God in the conversation at all. And it's always interesting, I think, when we're members of Alcoholics Anonymous, and our book talks about it over and over again, is for us to pray for what God's will is for. It's always one of the things I think is the mark about, are you really in the game? When it gets really serious, do you even want to know what God wants for you? And a lot of us go kind of nuts. At the time that we're going nuts, we don't want to know what God wants for us. That's not a question that we're up for answering. I'm going through kind of a tough time business-wise, and my biggest fear is that God wants me to be poor and happy. and it is, you know, we say we don't have conditions. <You know? laughs> I want God's will for me, but But, I mean, isn't that funny? We have a fear that, that if I really open myself up to what God would have me do, to what I still have this part of me that thinks I'm going to go be a missionary in China. And so I'm resistant to opening myself, completely opening myself up for what that is. And I think that's nonsense. I really think it's nonsense. And I think we rob ourselves. I think I rob myself of peace in that process. I think I rob myself of being held in the hands of God as opposed to trying to figure it out myself. The stress that I feel trying to go through the circumstances that I'm in right now is when I use my little I intellect to figure out a plan that's going to get me through the woods. And most of the problems that I get presented with in my life, when they're right in front of me and they're really fairly significant, what we do when we have those situations is we do a dump. We boot up our computer and we dump everything we know about the circumstances and situation we're in on the screen. I'm 66 years old. Almost all the solutions to the circumstances that I've had in my life come from off screen. They don't come from the resolution that I, you know, so I'm sitting here with just my share of just only what I see. You know, I'm old enough now that I should figure out, first of all, there's a lot I don't see. And there's a lot of stuff I see that isn't. And then I've got to figure out something that, as they say, most of the solution with your children, with your spouse, with your situation, something happens that you never even considered. And it comes in. And so I'm just, I think there's I have a tendency in Alcoholics Anonymous to rely on what I know. And that's, I think, shortchanging myself. I mean, because I got an answer. I got an answer for almost everything. You can give me multiple choice tests. I can tell you what to do, or I can, you know. And I don't think the advice would be all that bad, but I think that's busy work. I think that the peace that I'm really looking for is what Sandy talked about, is to be okay with what's around me, be in front of life on life's terms, to be able to be in front of that. And somehow, if not have the confidence, I don't know if confidence is the right word, or trust is the right word. But I think that's what we have. My dear friend Frank showed up unexpectedly to surprise me with a joyful event that was. And I think when you get together with old friends, and I feel the same way with Sandy and other people in this room, and you talk, we all have a sense for each other that it's going to be okay. We sometimes don't have it for ourselves. And that's one of the things that good friends who I've walked this walk with in the program give me. Just being by them encourages me have a sense it's going to be okay. 66 years old, have you ever had anything that hasn't turned out? No, but this one might not. And so that isn't exactly in the subject of surrender, but it is, I think I and we rely entirely too much on what we know. Even what we know about the steps, even what we know about the program. And not enough on, I think it was easier for us to say in 1950 or 1960 or 1970 that I don't know what's going to happen. I don't know. We'll see. Today, I think there's a much stronger tendency that we've got to somehow figure that out. Can you make any sense of that?
Yes,
I'm done talking. Thank you.
Before I get started on that, I'm going to share something that happened to me recently. And I want to do it not to just cover this topic, but to teach you a lesson. Because three people taught me a lesson.
Listen to this.
And I want to pass it on. About 30 years ago, I was up in Washington, D.C., and on the local television, an Afro-American lady was being interviewed by the TV guy, and her son had just been murdered by another teenager. And her son was just an innocent bystander. So the TV guy wanted to get her while she was all upset so he'd have a good show. And he said, how do you feel about the boy that did it? And she said, I've already forgiven him. And I couldn't believe my ears. I looked at her, and she was as calm as a cucumber. And just repeated it, that I've already forgiven him. And the TV guy didn't know where to go with that. He was stuck. And he just mumbled something and went off. And then about, 15 years ago, there was a lady in AA who had the same thing happen. And the first thing she said was, I've already forgiven him. And the third one was the Amish. And that was on TV. And these murders took place, and they went over, the family of the murdered child went over to the family where the son did the killing to see if they could comfort him. This raised my sights way up. And I used to talk about these three things to my friends. I said, do you remember this? Do you remember that? Because it just stuck with me. Like, I can't believe that. But it became part of me. And I don't know why I'm crying now, but many of you know last month my youngest daughter was murdered in her home up in Connecticut. And so I suddenly had the same situation that my teachers had happened to them. And I'm here to just tell you what happened. My other daughter who found the body called me up. She said, are you sitting down, Dad? And I said, yeah. She said, well, Barbie was murdered this morning. And I saw these people. And before she finished telling me about it, I had completely accepted it and had forgiven whoever did it. And when I say completely accepted, I said, as of this second in time, my relationship with my daughter Barbie is on a new level. The new relationship will consist solely of memories and stories. So that I'll take all my pleasure in telling you all about her. And she was in AA, and she had 5 years, and I spoke at a conference that she was the chairman of. So I have, from that second forward, a whole new relationship. And I don't care who did it. It's none of my business. That's up to the law authorities. I don't have a stake in that at all. It's not part of it. Because of those teachers, I am not dealing with anger. I'm not dealing with resentment, and I'm not dealing with hatred. I'm dealing with sorrow, which is the only thing God asks us to deal with in situations like that. Sorrow. Sorrow is easy compared to anger, resentment, and hatred. And the anger, resentment, and hatred come from the ego. It shouldn't have happened. Why did it happen to me? I got to get even. I got to do it. And all of that. And the amount of suffering that those three cause are gigantic compared to sorrow, because God helps us with sorrow. And he won't help us with hatred. He said, you want to get rid of hatred? Forgive. You want to get rid of resentment? Accept. Just embrace it. This happened. So he gives us the tools to get rid of those, and then he'll help us with sorrow. And I'm so grateful for those teachers that I just saw. So I'm just telling you that that's what happened to me, and it's a very powerful thing. It's unbelievable, because when you do it in the second that it happens, you don't give the ego a toehold to develop resentment or hatred or anger. Because once they get in the door, they are going to be there. Because once that happened, I started hearing from around the country, and one guy called and told me, he said, I stayed angry for 12 years. That is a terrible sentence to inflict on yourself. I stayed angry for 12 years. That's just crazy.
And so the tools are here to handle situations of a very high magnitude if we're willing to do that. Now, in other words, in order to be willing to do this, you have to let the universe off the hook. You have to say to the universe, okay, it's okay that that happened. You can't go, that shouldn't have happened. I can't believe it ever happened. And it had no effect on my relationship with a loving God. It didn't change it at all. It made me more grateful that I had this loving God to help us through everything. He has nothing to do with what this happens or doesn't happen or any of those things. And so from now on, I'll just show you a picture of her and I at the convention, and I'll tell you about all the good work. And they had a memorial ceremony, 50 family members, 300 AAs, and the place was celebrating. And everybody was alive with the life that this young woman did. So I just wanted to get that in because there's such a big lesson in there. And you have to remember that it's, if you do it in the second that it's happening, you eliminate having to deal with resentment and anger. That those are the killers. And so it says acceptance is the key to everything. Forgiveness. How many times does Bill write about forgiveness in the prayer of St. Francis? It is, if we ever forgave everything that ever happened to us in our life, we would have a very light burden that we're carrying around because we remember stuff and we're not going to let it go off the hook. I remember my sponsor tricked me one day, years ago. Guy had done something and I hate him. And he said, well, can you ever imagine, like years from now, letting it go and forgiving? Oh, yeah. Well, then why not do it now? So if you're holding on to something, why not let it go now? Then you're the one that gets out of jail. Anyway, let me pass it back to Bob. I just wanted to get that off.
A month or so ago, when you said those words to me over the telephone when we were talking, first thing came to mind is that our spiritual life is not a theory. You know, it is real. And it's really powerful. In addition to being powerful, it makes my problems look like chicken crap, which I
put the little one together.
I don't know if he intended that, because I was doing really well focusing on my problem. I'm having trouble remembering what it was. But but isn't that true? That therein lies the dilemma of life. I've got a little business issue that I have painted on my eyeball, and at times it's all I can see. And then regularly in meetings, we are presented with something that breaks through all of it. I mean, you just see it in little pieces. You see it in the hallway of the hotel, or you see it in one of the women at the meeting sharing something that's very powerful, and we get to see the power of God. We get to see the grace. We get to see how the program works. The ability to be with life, in life, as it is, with all the texture that it is. And to be okay. To be where our feet are. And to have it, to be in the now. To be present. All the great spiritual writers want to be present. They don't want to be in the past. It'll be in the future. Most of us have a tendency to be fleeing from the past because it isn't the way we need it to be, towards an imaginary future which will give us resolution, to an imaginary person which will give us resolution, relationship. And we're wasting the moment that we can attend to. That's one of our slogans about one day at a time. And if you break that down to a moment at a time, or now is the time. There's just never a problem now. And when Sandy was talking, I bet if I would have been able to measure everybody in the room, none of us would have had a problem. You know, 2 hours from now, many of us will be back focused on our little universe, doing that. And that is the sort of thing I really love, when I was talking before, and I don't know how well I did it, but I said how unusual it is. I think the grace in AA is that we are forced to have a real relationship with the God of our understanding, not a hypothetical one, not one based on theology, not one based on belief. But because in AA, we only will listen to conversations that are real conversations, that you're really involved in. And we're talking about sharing your experience, strength, and hope. We don't want a secondhand story. We don't want you telling us about what your brother thinks or did, or what your sister thinks or did. We want you to communicate what you're doing, and not just from the neck up. How we listen will be probably determined by how you are in the sharing. And as long as it's real, as long as it's yours, and as long as it has integrity, we'll listen to it pretty well, judgment-free. And if we don't agree with it, we just let it go through. And if we do agree with it, it may wash over us like a warm bath. And we get to do that hundreds of times a year. We get to walk into our meetings with brothers and sisters in AA and talk about life and how we're living it and how it's working and how it's not working. And to talk about it in the context of spiritual principles which have been given in the program. And to be in a room of people who, while we're not maybe close socially, everybody in that room wants your life to be good. That is not a small deal. I mean, I don't know where else you can go in the world to truly be able to sit. I think churches, I think we all usually hold goodwill for each other, but I do think it's amazing to sit in a room with people who have all had a spiritual experience, and if they were to try to describe it, wouldn't be able to. And if the closer they got, their experience would be very different and very scattered. And yet everybody in the room, young and old, black and white, rich and poor, would have had, if you would have just walked up and said, have you had a spiritual, you know, if they could say it in a private place, they've had their spiritual experience. There's no doubt about that. I mean, that, go to a bus and ask that question. I mean, it is the privilege that we have, the environment that we have been offered, for the support of our maintaining our spiritual condition is extraordinary. To be able to hear what Sandy just shared is extraordinary. And it helps me.
Thanks, buddy. I'm going to pick on a sentence in the big book that I think is kind of fun to think about. We read it a lot, and I don't know if we take it as seriously as we should. And the sentence is, our problems, we think, are of our own making. And it appears somewhere else, and I can't recall exactly, but it ends up saying, our problems are of our own making. So if you have a problem, do you believe you made it? Is that how you officially recorded it in your head? Or have you got one that someone else made? But it doesn't say that. It doesn't say our problems are sometimes of our own making and sometimes made by other people. And so, suppose we believe that. Suppose we really believe that. Said, all the problems I have, I made. I created. How do you create a problem? There's some building material to make a problem. And it's called thinking. All problems are built out of thought. And then, if you get good enough thoughts, your emotions get involved because they react to the thought. I just had the most horrible thing ever happen in the world to me. Now you're going to get an emotional reaction to that.
Oh.
And then you find out, well, what was it? They were out of bubble gum. I had to settle for a candy bar. Oh, my God, that is awful.
You know who an alcoholic called when he had the flat tire? Suicide prevention.
Yes. Oh. That's exactly what I'm talking about. That we create our own misery. When they say misery is optional, that's what they mean. They mean you have to create it, and it's created, oddly enough, if you really look at it, it's created with adjectives. In other words, life happens, and then we put adjectives on it. Rotten, awful, disgusting, blah, blah, blah. But it didn't come out that way. It rained this afternoon. The farmer's all happy. I was going to play golf. And that's when that miserable, rotten rain came down. Now I'm reacting to my thoughts about miserable, rotten rain and how it ruined my afternoon, and now I'm furious. And if I do it well enough, I can go get a drink. Because anyone would drink with a problem that big. How big? The one I made. When I make a problem, it is really big, and it can't be fixed. There's no sense talking to a sponsor, because he'll just try to talk me out of it. This problem is big, big. How did it get up there to that level? I cooked it. Put it in the oven. Put some resentment and anger and all that. So when we say our problems of our own making, you really have to believe that. How did I trick myself into getting so upset? How did I trick myself into getting so upset? Use those things. And then trick yourself into feeling better. I've done that a lot. I just start thinking all these other things, and then I just go, hey, there's a meeting tonight, man. Or I'm coming here, I'm going to see Bob. That's going to be a lot of fun. Okay, yeah, you feel better. Yeah, but you just trick yourself into feeling better. Well, I tricked myself into feeling bad in the first place. That's what I did. I tricked myself into feeling bad. But the ego likes trouble. Its whole life depends on problems. That's where it gets its identity. That's where it gets its separation from God. Otherwise, we'd be just a happy little child of God, which is all we actually are. And we want to be more than that. I'm a happy little child of God. And we start adding all these other things on top of it, which is why anonymity and humility are so powerful. They bring us down to where events simply happen. They're not good. They're not bad. Those the labels that we have to put on them. So when I sponsor people and they have a problem, I say, come on over. And they think we're going to talk about the problem. And we're not. I'm going to convince them they don't have a problem. And we're going to sit there looking at it differently until they finally go, well, yeah, if you look at it that way. And I said, that's the way you want to look at it. So the problems are we're seeing it wrong. We have the wrong glasses on. That's why Chuck got that wonderful book, New Pair of Glasses. When you put those on, you don't have a problem. And I don't think that could happen. I think that's impossible, that there's some power in here. You put these glasses on, problems go away. Well, we are the last class of people who ever ought to think that way, because what happened on the third drink when you went into a bar to your problems? Gone. You just looked around and said, now this is more like it. This is more like it. I like this world. So we already know about a power that can cause us to see that there aren't any problems. And so that's why I like that sentence. Our problems of our own making. Okay, Mr. B.
Well, if you look at it that way, I think mine's different, but I don't think it's entirely of my own making. Yeah, they're of our own making. Anyway, you talk, I have nothing to say.
Well, you get a new topic.
like the one we were on.
Oh,
just that, you resolved it.
Oh. It isn't here anymore.
We're going to take a 10-minute break.
Then we'll come back and we'll do our 20 minutes and then we'll do questions and
all right.
Question and answer thing.
Am I on? I'm not. There it is. I'm not on now?
You are.
You don't know how much fun it is to be with my buddy here. I just look forward to it. So anyway, he said that I have to come up with another topic, so I'll come up with a topic that whenever I look at Bob, I can't help but think of this topic.
Can I leave the room?
The topic is humility. So I thought I'd spend a little time talking about it. The reason is that it's one of the most powerful tools we have available in the program, and I think it gets under-mentioned. And I think one of the culprits is somebody started a sentence. It was around when I got sober, so it's not new. That if you say you're humble, you're not. Or you've heard, or something word to that effect. If you even let the word come out of your mouth, there's something unhumble about that. So no talking about humility. You follow what I'm saying? All of a sudden you go, well, I don't want to be seen as a jerk, so I'm not even going to say the word. And yet the word is, it is so amazingly powerful. And Bill really gets into it in the seventh step in the 12 and 12, which is why Bob and I are big believers in using both books. Because there is stuff in the big book that is far superior to the same material in the 12 and 12. But on the other hand, there's a few things in the 12 and 12 that are head and shoulders above the coverage in the big book. This is just in my opinion. And certainly humility is one of the topics that is there. I would call humility the passport out of self-centeredness, and there's no way to get out of there without it. You can't possibly get out of self-centeredness without humility. Because humility is saying, I can't get out of self-centeredness on my own. It's impossible for me, with all my resources, with all my energy, with all my knowledge, I can do nothing about being self-centered. And self-centered is one of the most painful things you can experience. It's the worst place to be in the world. And so when we finally admit that, then since we're not humble, but we've admitted we're self-centered, we immediately say, well, then I'll do something about being self-centered. Oh, really? What are you going to do? What are you going to do to stop being self-centered? Well, I'll just stop being self-centered. Really? You will stop being self-centered. And you find out you can't. Now, I don't blame people for being self-centered. I don't know how you could not be self-centered. When we start out in life as a little kid and you go out in the backyard and you look around at the world, guess what's at the center of it while you're looking around? There's the neighbor's house, there's the farm, there's this, and what's in the middle? Me. I mean, you can possibly not conclude that you're at the center of your own little world. So we all should realize that it's not our fault that we ended up self-centered. And if you remember back in history when they thought that the Earth was the center of the solar system, and boy, when the observers who started realizing we weren't, they were bringing some bad news to the
people in charge, the kings and everything, I always wanted to kill this guy. Because naturally, why would the earth be the center of the solar system? Because I live here. That's why it would be the center. The center is where I am. And so we can't help but be the center of our own little world. And that's the painful place that we live, that we're trying to destroy and come into God's world. And with these new pair of glasses, to be able to see a different world. So that when you get up and you see a different world, you're happy. And that's what humility does. It causes us to realize there's nothing that I can do to get out of self-centeredness. I must have help. And I must always be receiving help. Every time I get my chip every year, they always down in Florida, they go, how many years and how'd you do it? And I always say, by constantly receiving help. That's how I do it, by constantly receiving help. Normally talk about giving help, but receiving help is the key to everything. If we're not receiving it, we're going back to self-sufficiency, which leads to self-centeredness. And that's why humility is such an important thing. It's the opposite of pride. One of the characteristics of humility is it doesn't compare. If you find yourself comparing, you've moved over to pride. This is better than that. This is good, that's wrong. This is the humility is just accepts and goes on about its business. There's not making any judgments about anything. And I'm learning this at the same time that I am making the proud statement, my group's the best group in AA, and if you don't think your group's the best group in AA, go find another group. Did anybody ever hear that one? And I went, uh-oh. I don't think that fits in the humility column. I think that fits in the pride column. So we have to get comfortable with being able to talk about it and just say, boy, you know, humility really helped me out. It made me ask for help. It's a greatest thing to have is this new perspective that I need help constantly. And so that's what Bill is talking about when he says we humbly asked him to remove our shortcomings. And if you start with someone new and you say, do you understand asking him to remove your shortcomings? Yes, I do. I can see myself. Okay, God. Okay, now humbly ask. And then you find out that there's no, we have no idea the difference between regular asking and humbly asking. And that's why we want to study it and come get comfortable with this concept of humility. Humility is not getting my way. It's getting rid of even having a way in order to be in God's world. I have to start destroying my world the way it ought to be. This is the outcome we need. This is the thing. I got to have this. And so that's why this word to me is such a key word. And I learned something new, and then I'll pass it on to Bob. I used to make statements. Bill writes that humility has a hard time about it in our society. And I used to joke and say, you won't see a car manufacturer saying, buy a Porsche, everybody will think you're humble. It just wouldn't sell, you know what I mean? It's not a word that really grabs you. So I said, you'll never see it in the business world. That'll never be a big deal in the business world. And God, if I didn't think about, probably about 6 months ago, I said, wait a minute. When you were a little kid, you bought humble gasoline all the time. There was this huge oil company named Humble. It became Exxon. When it was Standard Oil, it became Exxon. So I went and looked up Humble. I said, how did they ever choose the word? How did you start an oil company and call it Humble? And it came from this little town in Texas. And this is how the town got its name. One of the earliest settlers there before the Civil War. Wait till you hear the guy's name. Pleasant Humble. You like that?
Wow.
His name was Pleasant Humble. And they called him Plez. And he moved there, and he started, there's a river, I guess the San Jacinto River is right there south of Houston. And he started a ferry boat service, and that was how he was earning his living. And then he decided to open a post office in his house. And the second he did that, Humble was on the map. It became an official place. It was later incorporated. It was a lumber town. Then they discovered oil. And so they created this little Humble Oil Company. And then that thing took off. I mean, it was all over the United States. And one of the last commercials they had was put a tiger in your tank. I don't know if any of you remember. They called it Esso was another name they used. And Enco was another name they used. And in the article that I read, they read Texaco was in every state. And this one wasn't in every state. So they had to go and switch their name in order to get in every state. And this is the sentence that they used. The Humble Oil Company executives had to swallow their pride. It just looks funny. The Humble had to swallow the pride. And so they became Exxon. And somewhere in this article, somebody from the Green Movement had found a Time or Life magazine ad from Humble Oil in 1962. And they had a picture of a glacier up in Alaska. I think a Tico or something like that. Glacier. And it said, Humble Oil produces enough energy every day to melt this glacier. And it was kind of an interesting look at the future. Anyway, that's my little trivia about Humble.
Well, the fact that you first of all related the subject to me, and then pick one that I don't do particularly well, I mean, makes it kind of difficult to participate. It's interesting. I brought up in a business environment. My dad worked for himself, and I ended up working with a partner, but kind of for ourselves, built my own company. And when I saw myself as a business guy, was being able to get things done, being able to do deals, to be able to affect, you know, problem solution, or this is what you want, you know, take a path and go get it. And especially the last few years when I had a few issues that I really didn't want to have that were kind of in front of my face. And I've really been touched every time I go read the 7-step and the 12 and 12. Bill's treatment of humility in that is just extraordinary. And what I discovered in that process is I really don't think bad things should happen to me. I mean, I'm not kidding. I mean, I don't know if I think I should be exempt. When it happens, the first thing is, you know, I don't want that. What the hell? You know, I mean, can we change it or minimize it or, and I think of how stupid. I mean, do you know anybody that doesn't get their, and it isn't. I mean, I don't think I do it pathologically, but I mean, my knee-jerk reaction is, you know, I don't know if my life is good enough that when something, you know, negative or whatever it happens, I don't like it. And I kind of have a reaction to it. And as I get older and those things, I think as I try to develop, I think some sense of humility is I stop, this feeling that I should somehow be exempt. That my life should be a procession of pleasure. And that I should be not, that I should not have the texture that most people have in life. You know, I mean, I commiserate with lots of other people and I try to have compassion when they're, you know, having difficulty. But, you know, so number one is I stop holding myself as someone who is exempt from gravity. I mean, you know, which I really think that there was an arrogance in my, And then I discover what a strong wanter I am. Mm. I am a wanting machine. Uh, I am a deeply shallow person. If you couldn't sell it to me, you ought to get out of the business, is what we used to say. So I was a materialist of the first water. And that's reduced quite a bit, both because of circumstances and because I just move away from it. It just was a fairly long period of my life, and it isn't where I am anymore, and it isn't, so I just don't participate in it nearly to the extent that I used to. I don't participate in it at all. But all these things kind of also relate to how, God-centered, self-centered, interior, exterior, is your solution? I mean, everything in the world, when Sandy talked about in the 40s and 50s and 30s, almost everybody was churched. You could talk about God. It wasn't even an issue. Now we can't even say the Pledge of Allegiance in public school. We have taken things so far kind of to the other side that we've lost some common sense, in this process. And it is, so today in that society, in a secular, in a primarily secular view of society, your solution has to be external. The closest it gets to internal is a psychologist. Psychology might be the religion of the day. That's acceptable enough to get, to gain some insight. But psychology, as one of my great spiritual teachers said, just takes, transfers the bomb from your lap to under your seat. It doesn't solve the problem. It is the resolution of most of the serious issues of life need a spiritual resolution. And they are not, and the resolution is what happened to me in Sandy's conversation. The resolution wasn't a resolution of my problem. The resolution is I didn't have a problem. And then I had nothing to say. There just isn't. You're sitting like a little foolishly in front of your, this place that you've been preparing, for the last 6 months as I wear my tear shirt. And I really told the story well. And then all of a sudden it's nothing. It really is. In this moment, you see it in a way that you, and that is how things happen in my program. My partner, has a phrase that he uses that I stole that says, see it or be it. If you don't see it, you are it. When you didn't see your alcoholism, it had you. When you saw your alcoholism, when you admitted your alcoholism, that relationship started to change. So when I don't see what Sandy was talking about, and we were talking about in the conversation, it had me. So all we did was have a conversation. And what I got to do was see it. And it dissolved. It just see it or be it. I saw it. And I was able, in this moment, now I will probably return to my suffering post, but but in that moment, there was nothing to talk about. I literally had nothing to say that would have been other than baloney, to do it. So it is, so for me, humility is, that I'm not exempt. Why should I be surprised when difficult things happen? Difficult things happen to everybody. So get over it. You're just one of the group of everybody. You're not exempt. And I really think I've spent a fair amount of my life trying to be exempt.
That's a good point.
I'm glad I had one finally.
Just to follow up on what Bob was saying about the changing society, I've noticed it in AA. So I'm going to summarize it all. This is how far we've come the other way. I can summarize it all in one sentence. I love being able to reduce things to one sentence. Matter of fact, when I sponsor people and they comment at discussion meetings and it takes them 7 minutes, I go, I want you to go home and reduce that to two sentences. And that's very spiritual progress. Because simplicity is spirituality. So if you can reduce your comments to two sentences, you just got to the essence of what you're trying to say. And it's a great spiritual discipline. So here's my one sentence. In an AA group today, if you mention the word Jesus, you better be swearing. That's my comment. On today. A couple more things on humility. We do humble things all the time, and we don't see them as humble. If you go to a meeting, it's an act of humility. Why are you going to a meeting? Because you need help. You're not going to make it through life unless you go there. If you read the big book, it's an act of humility. Well, I'm going to read this. I need help. If you pray, it's an act of humility. And one of the great acts of humility is anonymity. That you simply are, you don't have a resume anymore. You're just Joe the drunk. How simple that is. That's my whole who I am. Just a name, and I'm an alcoholic. That's a huge act of humility. So we're engaging in humble acts all the time. And I think if we saw it that way, the word would become a bigger part of our vocabulary. We'd be able to talk about it a lot more. Now, are we going to get another topic, or are we going to go for questions?
Questions.
We just got the answer to that. Okay, we're going to do this, and if we don't get any, I'll ask Bob questions.
And that is what we call desperation as opposed to humility.
There we go. Thank you. You saved us. Here comes a microphone.
Jim, I'm an alcoholic. Can you give us an example of when one of your sponsees comes to you with a problem, how you give them the current glasses to look at?
Yeah.
You want to start or you want me to start?
Well, I'm not going to touch it.
Okay. I use the same technique my sponsor used on me when I was new. When I would go to him every month, the sky is falling. If you remember when you knew that the end of the world is just around the corner every other day, and then you'd run in there. And he would listen to all this stuff. You know, I'm going to get through all the Marine Corps. I got six kids. We don't have enough money. I don't think we're going to starve to death. Now, why was that a problem for me? Because I kept thinking about it. Do you follow what I'm saying? Let me start out with this. How many people here have a problem that's not bothering you? Okay, so the essence of a problem is that it's bothering you. So if we could get you unbothered, would you still have a problem?
No.
In other words, when you go to the 10th step, if something disturbs you, no matter what the cause, there's something wrong with you. And then they show you how to get undisturbed, honest analysis, and open-mindedness, willingness to forgive, and a willingness to make amends. So anyway, I went to him with all these problems, and he said, okay, yeah, I hear that, but wait a minute, you know, you're scheduled to talk next week up in that big meeting up in Washington. And I went, yeah, I am. He said, you know, they really enjoy you, you're funny, and they really get a kick out of that, so I'm looking forward to driving up there. You see where he's going? He's taking me down a different road. We're not even going to talk about what it is that got me upset. And then he said, and you're sponsored the guy now. How's he doing? Oh, he's doing great. What step are you on? Oh, around the second step. Yeah, I'm going to teach him this and this and that. So after a while, he said, well, how do you feel now? And I said to him, well, if you look at it that way, I guess I don't have as big a problem as I thought I did. So what did he do? He caused me to look at life a different way. And if I'm not thinking about the problem, it doesn't exist. There are people with terminal cancer. When they're not thinking about it, they're the same as everybody else. And then their ego wants them to go think about it, feel sorry for themselves, and turn it into a terrible problem. And then they get free helping somebody else, and then it's not a problem. So it is all helping someone to see and think differently so that they're not disturbed by the situation. It's just a situation. When it upsets us, it's a problem. You get rid of the upset. That's why, Bob, you started the whole thing out. I'm afraid God's going to make me happy and poor. You follow what I'm saying? That is the answer. In other words, if you're unhappy financially and somebody can make you happy, the problem's gone. But it's not the solution he wanted. But it's the solution. And so, anyway, that's what I do on that area. So,
that's all I know.
TV alcohol. I know, Sandy, you talk a lot about what you do across the country to bring people good news. And I was wondering, how hard is it to get up there and do what you guys do and keep the ego out of it?
That's yours.
The short answer is that I don't. I think it's interesting in Asia, most people who do anything for which we would get attention, whether it would be you were the group leader for a couple of months or whatever task of service, I think often in service we get called by our ego. You know, you do the presentation of the meeting. I mean, there's a part of that that's attractive, and we get called through it. That may get you there. It won't keep you there. So over a period of time, it becomes more ordinary, something that you're able to do with a different facility. You look at it differently. I think most of the time we look at it as service. And there are ego-enhancing aspects to it. People treat you nicely. They tell you, oh, you did a wonderful job. There's still ego sorts of things in it, but I really think after you do it a while, it becomes more of just a service. There are times when you believe you're pressed. There are times when you're more elated when people are blowing smoke at you. Not smoke. I grew up listening to talks. They made a very big difference in my sobriety. And I think I was, I don't know if I was so interested because at one point in time I was going to, you know, have to do that. But I think everything in life, we have an opportunity to act either with our ego or with some humility. And I think that's something as spiritual people with principles, we have to learn. And sometimes we don't do it perfectly, but over a period of time, I think with the principles that we have, we don't tolerate ego. Really funny, in our society, I think if we had someone who was overly prideful about something, we'd start to reduce asking them. Pass.
Yeah. It's, you know, when people come up and they give you all this, oh, you helped me, you did this, blah, 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 blah. It's easy to get a high out of that, which would be the ego. Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. It makes me feel sick when I do it. I just feel terrible about that because I know that this is God's gets all the credit for everything in AA. And I'll give you an example of it recently. Because of my daughter's death, I got a bunch of people in AA from all over started writing me cards. I think I got 240 of them from all over the place. And a lot of the cards said, well, I don't know you, but I've been listening to this, and you really mean, and I'm so sorry to hear what happened. And so these things started piling up in a big basket. And so a friend of mine came over one day and I said, let me show you all these cards. And I was having him read so he could read all these nice things these people said about me. It had nothing to do with my daughter. And I started having that feeling as I gave it to him, and I just took him and put it in the other room. But it's very easy for that ego part to sneak back in. It looks for any opportunity to direct the attention. So here I am directing the attention from my daughter to me, and it looked innocent. You know what I'm saying? If somebody could sit there and go, oh, yeah, this is so-so-so, and they don't realize, yeah, but did you read the part about me? And that's when you take the basket and go put it in the other room. So as Bob said, nobody's immune from this. You better get used to it, because you're going to get caught up every day, and then you just, we got a whole step about that, and when you're wrong, promptly admit it. Well, that was screwed up. Give me that basket. And then go in there. And lastly, and don't beat yourself up over it. Don't go, oh my God, I can't believe you know, that's pride again. I can't believe I fell for that. I mean, you're compounding the felony.
Hi, I'm Nancy, and I'm an alcoholic. My question is for Sandy. I admire spirituality. Could you tell me what third step meant to you back when you first got sober, and if it still means the same to you now? And if you find yourself taking your will back, what do you do to give it back?
Well, very quickly, I just covered turning it back over is to admit you're wrong. Boy, being wrong is ticket, peace of mind. Okay, wrong. So that's a, you get your spirituality back. You admit you're wrong. I let it go. I did this, I did that. The third step in the beginning is very different than it is now, because in the beginning, my sponsor explained to me. He used the second step in the big book, the chapter of the agnostic, where it says, you have a disease that only a spiritual experience can conquer. So he said, your disease requires that a higher power appear or you're dead. So I was sort of getting a mafia-like understanding about whether I'm going to choose God or not. So I'm looking at the third step, making a decision, and he's standing behind me with a gun. So I'm going to make this decision because there's nowhere else to go. I have to change my mind or the gun goes off. Do you follow what I'm saying? But now that I've had the full experience of God, it's a very joyful thing. And the third step is especially joyful to me when I'm sponsoring someone and we come to this obstacle of their ego not wanting them to turn their life over and to make it so attractive that they decide to do it. It's so exciting to see that crucial decision being made in another human being's life.
Well, an ant on a log going down the river, it has the illusion, it looks like I'm steering the log.
Yes. There's a hand way over there. Oh, okay.
I'm not even there. I'm not all there. I'm working with someone right now through a struggle with the diet issue. Do you think that the struggle with the diet issue has changed that much over the last 30 or so years?
I think it, I've got a part of me that could answer that no, but yeah, I do. I just think that we're so secular today. I think that everybody, there are people today that have had, they haven't been churched at all. I mean, haven't had, they haven't even had many, almost any preliminary conversations about God or what they believe. I mean, most of the problems that we have in our society around God, I think our problem is laziness. I mean, we don't read anything about God. We don't, I mean, we keep talking about how important it is. And then we don't want anybody to know that we really haven't read anything about it or even talked about it much. So we just, I don't, I mean, a lot of times the answer we give is, you know, is to get people, is to close down the conversation because it isn't, it's like nuclear physics. It isn't something, you know, I mean, I don't want to sit down and have a half hour conversation about nuclear physics. I don't understand it. I don't read anything about it. What would I have to say? I mean, you know, and you just expose that. Any kind of a conversation I got onto would quickly be disclosed that I have almost no experience in the conversation. And that is more so today with more people, I think, than it ever has been. What also is wonderful about it is once you open the conversation, there are things that you can help them recognize and see as part of that conversation that they have never thought about or recognized and see. You can start to see the natural knower inside of them, the sense of being the God inside of them. And as Sandy said, that's a pretty wonderful thing to be able to assist what is kind of a transformation taking place. But I think it's different because our society is different. And the and there's almost no external encouragement for it except in the pretty strongly organized religions.
Okay, one comment. When I run into, you know, an atheist or somebody who doesn't want to hear about God or anything like that, I follow what the big book suggests. And the big book says, oh, well, let's not worry about that. Let's go to a meeting. Let's talk about this. Just keep an open mind. Don't worry about that. And you just, you don't go into the debate. All right, well, let's settle this issue right now. You say no, I say yes. That would ruin everything. So you go, oh, well, let's not worry about that yet. That'll come later. And we're just talking about the steps and surrender. We're doing this, and he's going to meetings, and I love to go to speaker meetings. When I got sober, all the meetings were speaker meetings. Few discussion, but you couldn't go there. You had 3 months, and then you couldn't talk. And so they will hear attractive things about God from other people, and one of them will be just like them. And so the work will slowly get done, and they'll be attracted to reconsidering as you're working them through the steps.
I can't hear.
I'm having trouble hearing the question.
I've never heard anything in regards to a setting like this, in regards to wife?
Oh, chapter to wives. Yeah. Oh, yeah, okay.
So, and what's the question with respect to the chapter to the wives?
Any feedback in regards to wives and how to conduct themselves and work through the process of sobriety and relationships? And even your experiences that you can use in the style?
Well, I have one observation, and that is there are many new women who don't like the chapter. New to AA, because it's so out of touch with today's reality. And once again, don't engage in an argument. Don't try to prove that it's okay. Make a little bet inside of your head
that 2 years from now they'll find a lot of beautiful things in there, and that that resentment at the foreign nature of it compared to today's way of things will slowly disappear, because there's a lot of beautiful things in there. But I certainly am sympathetic with somebody who would look at that and be offended almost. But you just let time fix these things, because you just can't jump in and, no, you're wrong, you shouldn't feel that way. So I'm sympathetic to your point. Did I come to that all right?
Yeah, I go to a sober house on Tuesday nights, most Tuesday nights, and it's all men, and they read after to the family, and they read the chapter to the spouse, and they almost always initially start out saying, well, I don't have much to say, and, you know, don't like it. And then as their stay lengthens, they start to become more sensitive about their own experience within their family, and they start to mine things out of that they don't. But at the end, the question to me when you said, well, we have advice, you know, Bill wrote that chapter, which I always thought was a little unusual. And secondly, I would find myself thinking, I wish my wife were here. You know, the Al-Anon experience of, you know, before and after, because, I mean, that really is the essence of what's, and we're the carriers. So.
Here we go.
Yeah, I'm an alcoholic. And I had a question for Bob. I have a comment first.
It's about time.
You know, in the big book, there's a sentence that says that deep down inside every man, woman, and child is a fundamental idea. And in my early sobriety, I heard Bob, the civil law of California, Bob talked about, you know, he said, I'm going to stand up here today. He was raised an atheist. He said, I'm going to stand up here today and talk about God. And then Stan C. out of Canada, he openly said, you know, that he had never been raised in the church, but that he had that feeling inside of him every time he did something, you know, that went against the nature of God. And that's how I started out, too, you know, every time I did something, I had that feeling inside. So I believe that sentence in the big book.
Mm-hmm.
I was going to ask Bob, in these different countries that you've been to, how do they open and close their meetings? And then I have another thing too, that at the General Service Conference this year, they were supposed to vote on a pamphlet that was going to address
atheists
and non-believers.
Yeah.
And
I did.
It lost out in favor of pregnant nuns on motorcycles pamphlet. We have a we have. I think the I didn't have enough of exposure in China to be able to answer your question. The meetings, many of the meetings, I went to were with expatriates, and they open and close like we open and close our meetings. So many of the meetings you go to in foreign countries are. Yeah, the meeting I went to in India was not in Hindi; it was in English. Now. That was there. I mean, English is really is the, one of the main languages of India. It was not I mean, there were mostly Indians at the meeting. And they conducted the meeting the same way we would here, with the same prayers and the same, I don't know, remember if they said the Lord's Prayer or their Serenity Prayer, but you wouldn't find all, my memory of it is that there was nothing different. Same thing in South Africa. Most of the meetings in foreign countries I've been to have been comprised, you know, in the Scandinavian countries where they were not comprised of expatriates, I, to whatever extent I understood what was going on, and I think I did. Their format and what they did was quite similar to what we do. And I do believe that there's a, I think there's a knower, when we can quiet our minds enough, either through meditation or what happens, I think what happens is we bring our wet log to the bonfire of AA. And I think it starts to dry out. And what happens a little bit is we check our brains at the door. And you move into the group for the hour that the group's going on, and there's a collective conscious in the group. And you join it. And it has an impact on you. I think when you come in sad, the group raises you, so you're not quite as sad. When you come in separate, angry, whatever it is, I think you rise, the impact of the collective consciousness of the group, and that, to some extent, then we start to take that outside. You know, but at first, it's only in the group that we have any kind of, you know, peace or resolution. But there are things that you're in a meeting, and someone like Sandy says something, and you go, oh, yeah. You don't go, oh, I agree with that. Geez, that's interesting. I mean, your soul just goes, oh, yeah. It doesn't think it's okay. It doesn't think it's correct. It knows it is so. And you start to have an experience of your knower, which is getting pretty close to your higher power. And I think we have those experiences with some regularity in Alcoholics Anonymous. I think we see when whoever talked about Sandy or whoever David, when the change happens to someone, they look different. They're different. So when you talk about the spirit, I mean, and we see that. We see that often. So I really think we get a chance to see it and touch it and feel it. And there are many places I think one could go to see it more often than we have the opportunity to see it. Yeah, that's an interesting point. I think we have a prejudice, so, you know, it's always the problem of the majority. You know, we all have a tendency to think a certain way, and atheism is not a common, you know, it's not something that we run into every day, and, you know, it's not as common, certainly, it seems to be, as someone who's theistic. That's an interesting point I've taken. And it's 2:30, and we need an hour between us, so thank you very much. We're good to meet you.
Thanks for listening. I hope you enjoyed the podcast. Sobercast is ad-free, and we'd like your help in order to keep it that way. So if you'd like to help us be self-supporting by pledging $1 or $2 a month, visit Sobercast.com and look for the donate links. Thank you very much.